Chapter 7. It was dark when the airliner limousine reached LaGuardia Field. I had intended taking an earlier plane, but Dubarry persuaded me to stay over for dinner. We dropped into the Algonquin, next door to True's office building. Halfway through dinner, I asked John what he thought of the space travel answer. "Oh, it's possible," he said cautiously. "The time and space angles make it hard to take, but if we're planning to explore space within 50 years, there's no reason some other planet people couldn't do it. Of course, if they've been observing us for over a century, as those old sightings seem to indicate, they must be far ahead of us, at least in technical progress." Later on, he said thoughtfully, "Even though it's possible, I hate to think it's the answer. Just imagine the impact on the world. We'd have to reorient our whole lives, and things are complicated enough already." Standing at the gate, waiting for my plane to be called, I thought over that angle. Assuming that space travel was the solution, which I still couldn't believe, what would be the effect on the world? It was a hard thing to picture. So much depended on the visitors from space. What would their purpose be? Would they be peaceful or hostile? Why had they been observing the Earth so intensively in the past few years? I could think of 100 questions. What would the space people be like? Would they be similar to men and women on Earth, or some fearsome Buck Rogers-ish creatures who would terrify the average American, including myself? It was obvious they would be far superior to us in many ways. But their civilization might be entirely different. Evolution might have developed their minds, and possibly their bodies, along lines we couldn't even grasp. P-plus-er-ups we couldn't even communicate with them. What would be the net effect of making contact with beings from a distant planet? Would Earthlings be terrified, or, if it seemed a peaceful exploration, would we be so intrigued by the thought of a great adventure? It would depend entirely on the space visitor's motives, and how the world was prepared for such a revelation. The more I thought about it, the more fantastic THC thing seemed. And yet it hadn't been too long since airplane flight was considered an idiot's dream. This scene here at LaGuardia would have seemed pure fantasy in 1900. THC huge constellations and DC-6s, the double-deck stratocruisers, sweeping in from all over the country, the big ships at Pan American, taking off for points all over the globe. We'd come a long way in the 46 years since the Wright brothers' first flight. But space travel. The gateman checked my ticket, and I went out to the Washington plane. It was a luxury ship, a 52-passenger, 4-engine DC-6, scheduled to be in the capital 1 hour after takeoff. By morning this plane, the Aztec, would be in Mexico City. The couple going up the gangway ahead of me were in their late 60s. 50 years ago, what would they have said, if someone had predicted this flight? The answer to that was easy. At that time, high school songbooks featured a well-known piece entitled Darius Green and His Flying Machine. Darius, it seems, was a simple-minded lad who actually thought he could fly. 50 years. That was the time the Air Force had estimated it would take us to start exploring space. Would Americans come to accept space travel as matter-of-factly as the people now boarding this plane? The youngsters would, probably. The older ones, as a rule, would be a little more cautious. In the oval lounge at the rear of the plane, I took out the file of old sighting reports. Glancing through it, I saw excerpts from 19th century astronomical and scientific journals and extracts from official gazettes. Most of the early sightings had been in Great Britain and on the continent, with a few reports scattered around the world. The American reports did not begin until the latter part of the century. The DC-6 rolled out and took off. For a few minutes I watched the lights of Manhattan and Greater New York twinkling below. The Empire State Building Tower was still above us, as the plane banked over the East River. We climbed quickly, and the familiar outline of Manhattan took shape like a map pinpointed with millions of lights. any large city seen from the air at night has a certain magic, New York most of all. Looking down, I thought, what would a spaceman think, seeing this brilliantly lighted city, the towering skyscrapers? Would other planets have such cities, or would it be something new and puzzling to a visitor from space? Turning back to the old reports, I skipped through until I found the American sightings. One of the first was an incident at Bonham, Texas, in the summer of 1873. It was broad daylight when a strange, fast-moving object appeared in the sky, southwest of the town. For a moment, the people of Bonham stared at the thing, not believing their ears. The only flying device then known was the drifting balloon. But this thing was tremendous, and speeding so fast its outlines were almost a blur. Terrified farmers dived under their wagons. Townspeople fled indoors. Only a few hardy souls remained in the streets. The mysterious object circled Bonham twice, then raced off to the cast and vanished. Descriptions of the strange machine varied from round or oval to cigar-shaped. The details of the Bonham sighting were later confirmed for me by Frank Edwards, Mutual Network newscaster, who investigated this case. 24 hours after the Bonham incident, a device of the same description appeared at Fort Scott, Kansas. Panic-stricken soldiers fled the parade ground as the thing flashed overhead. In a few seconds it disappeared, circling toward the north. Until now, I had supposed that the term saucer was original with Kenneth Arnold. Actually, the first to compare a flying object with a saucer was John Martin, a farmer who lived near Denison, Texas. The Denison Daily News of January 25, 1878, gives the following account. From Mr. John Martin, a farmer who lived some 6 miles south of this city, we learn the following strange story. Tuesday morning while out hunting, his attention was directed to a dark object high up in the southern sky. The peculiar shape and velocity with which the object seemed to approach riveted his attention and he strained his eyes to discover its character. When first noticed, it appeared to be about the size of an orange, which continued to grow in size. After gazing at it for some time, Mr. Martin became blind from long looking, and left off viewing it for a time, in order to rest his eyes. On resuming his view, the object was almost overhead, and had increased considerably in size, and appeared to be going through space at wonderful speed. When directly over him, it was about the size of a large saucer, and was evidently at great height. Mr. Martin thought it resembled, as well as he could judge, a balloon. It went as rapidly as it had come, and was soon lost to sight in the heavenly skies. Mr. Martin is a gentleman of undoubted veracity, and this strange occurrence, if it was not a balloon, deserves the attention of our scientists. In the file, I saw a memo Dubarry had written. I would take the very early reports with caution. For instance, the one on August 9, 1762, which describes an odd, spindle-shaped body traveling at high speed toward the sun. I recall that Charles Fort accepted this, along with other early sightings, as evidence of spaceships. But this particular thing might have been a meteor. Meteors as such were almost unknown then. The later reports are more convincing, and it is also easier to check the sources, especially those from 1870 on. From 1762 to 1870, the reports were meager. Some described mysterious lights in the sky, a few mentioned round objects seen in daylight. Even though they were not so fully documented as later ones, one point struck me. In those days, there was no telegraph, telephone, or radio to spread news rapidly and start a flood of rumors. Page 59. A sighting in Scotland could not be the cause of a similar one 2 days later in the south of France. Beginning in 870, there was a series of reports that went on to the turn of the century. In the London Times, September 26, 1870, there was a description of a queer object that was seen crossing the moon. It was reported as elliptical, with some kind of tail, and it took almost 30 seconds to complete its passage of the moon. Then in 1871, a large, round body was sighted above Marseille, France. This was on August 1st. It moved slowly across the sky, apparently at great height, and was visible about 15 minutes. On March 22, 1880, several brilliantly luminous objects were reported seen at Katna, Germany. Sighted just before sunrise, they were described as rising from the horizon and moving from east to west. The account was published in the British Nature magazine, volume 22, page 64. The next report in the file mentioned briefly a strange round object seen in the skies over Bermuda. The source for this account was the Bermuda Royal Gazette. This was in 1885. That same year, an astronomer and other witnesses reported a gigantic aerial object at Adrianople, Turkey. On November 1st, the weird apparition was seen moving across the sky. Observers described it as round, and 4 to 5 times the size of the moon. This estimate is similar to the Denison, Texas, comparison with an orange. The object would actually be huge to be seen at any great height. But unless the true height were known, any estimate of size would be guesswork. On March 19, 1887, two strange objects fell into the sea near a Dutch Barkenton. As described by the skipper, Captain C.D. Sweet, one of the objects was dark, the other brightly luminous. The glowing object fell with a loud roaring sound. The shipmaster was positive it was not a meteor. In New Zealand, a year later, an oval-shaped disc was reported speeding high overhead. This was on May 4, 1888. About 2 years after this, several large aerial bodies were sighted hovering over the Dutch East Indies. Page 60. Most accounts described them as roughly triangular, about 100 feet on the base, and 200 feet on the sides. But some observers thought they might be longer and narrower, with a rounded base. This would make them agree with more recent stories of cone-shaped objects with rounded tops seen in American skies. On August 26, 1894, a British admiral reported sighting a large disc with a projection like a tail. And a year after this, both England and Scotland buzzed with stories of triangular-shaped objects like those seen in the Dutch East Indies. Although many officials scoffed at the stories, more than one astronomer stuck to his belief that the mysterious things might be coming from outer space. Since planes and dirigibles were then unknown, there was no one on Earth who could have been responsible for them. In 1897, sightings in the United States began to be more frequent. One of the strangest reports describes an incident that began on April 9th. Flying at a great height, a huge cigar-shaped device was seen in the Midwest. Short wings projected from the sides of the object, according to reports of astronomers who watched it through telescopes. For almost a week, the aerial visitor was sighted around the Midwest, as far south as St. Louis, and as far west as Colorado. Several times, red, green, and white lights were seen to flash in the sky. Some witnesses thought the crew of this strange craft might be trying to signal the Earth. On April 16th, the thing, whatever it was, disappeared from the Midwest. But on April 19th, the same object, or else a similar one, appeared over West Virginia. Early that morning, the town of Sisterville was awakened by blasts of the sawmill whistle. Those who went outside their homes saw a strange sight. From a torpedo-shaped object overhead, dazzling searchlights were pointing downward, sweeping the countryside. The thing appeared to be about 200 feet long, some 30 feet in diameter, with stubby wings and red and green lights along the sides. For almost 10 minutes the aerial visitor circled the town, then it swung eastward and vanished. The next report was published in the U.S. Weather Bureau's Monthly Weather Review. On page 115 in the March 1904 issue, there is an account of an odd sighting at sea. On February 24, 1904, a mysterious light had been seen above the Atlantic by crew members of the USS Supply. It was moving swiftly, and evidently at high altitude. The report was attested by Lieutenant Frank H. Schofield, USN. On July 2, 1907, a mysterious explosion occurred in the heavens near Burlington, Vermont. Some witnesses described a strange, torpedo-shaped device circling above. Shortly after it was seen, a round, luminous object flashed down from the sky, then exploded. Weather Review, 1907, page 310. Another cigar-shaped craft was reported at a low altitude over Bridgewater, Massachusetts, in 1905. Like the one at Sisterville, it carried searchlights, which swept back and forth across the countryside. After a few moments, the visitor rose in a steep climb, and the searchlights blinked out. There was no report for 1909 in America, though an odd aerial object was sighted near the Galapagos Islands. But in 1910, one January morning, a large silvery cigar-shaped device startled Chattanooga. After about 5 minutes, the thing sped away, appearing over Huntsville, Alabama, shortly afterward. It made a second appearance over Chattanooga the next day, then headed east, and was never seen again. In popular astronomy, January 27, 1012, a Dr. F.B. Harris described an intensely black object that he saw crossing the moon. As nearly as he could tell, it was gigantic in size, though again there was no way to be sure of its distance from him or the moon. With careful understatement, Dr. Harris said, "I think a very interesting and curious phenomenon happened that night. A strange shadow was noted on the clouds at Fort Worth, Texas, on April 8, 1903. It appeared to be caused by some large body hovering motionless above the clouds. As the cloud layer moved, the shadow remained in the same position. Then it changed size, diminishing, and quickly disappeared, as if it had risen vertically." A report on this was given in the Weather Bureau Review of that year, number 4-599 by 1919. Dirigibles were of course well known to most of the world. When a dirigible-shaped object appeared over Huntington, West Virginia, in July of that year, there was no great alarm. It was believed to be an American blimp, though the darkness, it was 11 at night, prevented observers from being sure. But a later checkup proved it was not an American ship, nor was it from any country possessing such craft. For some time after this, there were few authentic reports. Then in 1934, Nicholas Roerich, head of the American Roerich expedition into Tibet, had a remarkable experience that bears on the saucer riddle. On pages 361 and 362 of his book Altai Himalaya, Roerich describes the incident. The expedition party was in the wilds of Tibet one morning when a porter noticed the peculiar actions of a buzzard overhead. He called Roerich's attention to it. Then they all saw something high in the sky, moving at great speed from north to south. Watching it through binoculars, Roerich saw it was oval-shaped, obviously of huge size, and reflecting the sun's rays like brightly polished metal. While he trailed it with his glasses, the object suddenly changed direction, from south to southwest. It was gone in a few moments. This was the last sighting listed before World War II. When I had finished, I stared out the plane window, curiously disturbed. Like most people, I had grown up believing the Earth was the center of everything, life, intelligence, and religion. Now, for the first time in my life, that belief was shaken. It was a curious thing. I could accept the idea that we would eventually explore space, land on the moon, and go on to distant planets. I had read of the plans, and I knew our engineers and scientists would somehow find a way. It did not disturb my belief in our superiority. But faced with this evidence of a superior race in the universe, my mind rebelled. For years, I had been accustomed to thinking in comic strip terms of any possible spaceman, Buck Rogers stuff, with weird-looking spaceships and green-faced Martians. But now, if these sightings were true, the shoe was on the other foot. We would be faced with a race of beings at least 200 years ahead of our civilization, perhaps thousands. In their eyes, we might look like primitives. My conjectures before the takeoff had just been idle thinking. I had not really believed this could be the answer. But now the question came back sharply. How would we react to a sudden appearance of spaceships, bringing that higher race to the Earth? If we were fully prepared, educated to this tremendous adventure, it might come off without trouble. Unprepared, we would be thrown into panic. The lights of Philadelphia showed up ahead, and a thought struck me. What would Philadelphians of 1776 have thought to see this DC-6 flying across their city at 300 miles an hour? What would the sentries at Valley Forge have done, a year later, if this lighted airliner had streaked over their heads? Madness. Stampede. Those were the plain answers. But there was a difference now. We had had modern miracles, radio, television, supersonic planes, and the promise of still more miracles. We could be educated, or at least partly prepared, to accept space visitors. In 50 years we had learned to fly. In 50 years more, we would be exploring space. Why should we believe such creative intelligence was limited to the Earth? It would be incredible if the Earth, out of all the millions of planets, proved the only inhabited spot in the whole universe. But, instinctively, I still fought against believing that the flying saucers were spaceships. Eventually, we would make contact with races on other planets. They undoubtedly would someday visit the Earth. But if it could be put off, a problem for later generations to handle. If the disks proved American guided missiles, it would be an easier answer. Looking through the Project Saucer report Dubarry had loaned me, I read the space travel items, hoping to find some hint that this was a smokescreen. On page 18, in a discussion on Mars, I found this comment. Reports of strange objects seen in the skies have been handed down through the generations. However, scientists believe that, if Martians were now visiting the Earth without establishing contact, it could be assumed that they have just recently succeeded in space travel, and that their civilization would be practically abreast of ours. This because they find it hard to believe that any technically established race would come here, flaunt its ability in mysterious ways over the years, but each time simply go away without ever establishing contact. There could be several answers to that. The Martians might not be able to live in our atmosphere, except in their sealed spaceships. They, or some other planet race, could have observed us periodically, to check on our slow progress. Until we began to approach their level of civilization, or in some way caused them concern, they would probably see no reason for trying to make contact. But somehow I found a vague comfort in the argument, full of holes though it was. Searching further, I found other space travel comments. On one page, the Air Force admitted it was almost a certainty that space travelers would be operating from planets outside the solar system. But on the following page, I discovered this sentence. Thus, although visits from outer space are believed to be possible, they are thought to be highly improbable. What was the answer? Was this just a wandering discussion of possibilities, badly put together, or was it a hint of the truth? It could be the first step in preparing America for a revelation. It could also be a carefully thought-out trick. This whole report might be designed to conceal a secret weapon. If the Air Force or the Navy did have a secret missile, what better way to distract attention? The old sighting reports could have been seized on as a build-up for space travel hints. Then suddenly it hit me. Even if it were a smokescreen, what of those old reports? They still remained to be answered. There was only one possible explanation, unless you discarded the sightings as lies. That meant discrediting many reliable witnesses, naval officers, merchant shipmasters, explorers, astronomers, ministers, and responsible public officials. Page 65. Besides all these, there had been thousands of other witnesses where large groups had seen the objects. The answer seemed inevitable, but I held it off. I didn't want to believe it, with all the changes it might bring, the unpredictable effect upon our civilization. If I kept on checking, I might find evidence that would bring a different explanation for the present saucers. Dubarry had put another group of reports in the envelope. This series covered the World War II phase, and on up to the outbreak of the saucer scare in the United States. Some of it, about the Foo Fighters, I already knew. This was tied in with the mystery rockets reported over Sweden. The first Swedish sightings had occurred during the early part of the war. Most of the so-called ghost rockets were seen at night, moving at tremendous speed. Since they came from the direction of Germany, most Swedes believed that guided rockets were the answer. During the summer of 1946, after the Russians had taken over Peenemünde, the Nazi missile test base, ghost rockets again were reported flying over Sweden. Some were said to double back and fly into Soviet areas. Practically all were seen at night, and therefore none had been described as a flying disc. Instead, they were said to be colored lights, red, green, blue, and orange, often blurred from their high speed. But there was a puzzling complication. Mystery lights, and sometimes flying discs, were simultaneously reported over Greece, Portugal, Turkey, Spain, and even French Morocco. Either there were two answers, or some nation had developed missiles with an incredibly long range. By January 1947, ghost rocket sightings in Europe had diminished to less than one a month. Oddly enough, the first disc report admitted by Project Saucer was in this same month. The first 47 case detailed by Project Saucer occurred at Richmond, Virginia. It was about the middle of April. A Richmond weather observer had released a balloon, and was tracking it with a theodolite, when a strange object crossed his field of vision. He swung the theodolite and managed to track the thing, despite its high speed. The actual speed and altitude, the latter determined by a comparison of the balloon's height at various times, have never been released. Nor has the Air Force released this observer's report on the object's size, which Project Saucer admitted was more accurate than most witnesses' estimates. About the 17th of May 1947, a huge oval-shaped saucer 10 times longer than its diameter was sighted by Byron Savage, an Oklahoma City pilot. 2 days later, another fast-flying saucer was reported at Manitou Springs, Colorado. In the short time it was observed, it was seen to change direction twice, maneuvering at an unbelievable speed. Then on June 24th came Kenneth Arnold's famous report, which set off the saucer scare. The rest of the story I now knew almost by heart. When the DC-6 landed at Washington, I had made one decision. Since it was impossible to check up on most of the old sightings, I would concentrate on certain recent reports, cases in which the objects had been described as spaceships. As I waited for a taxi, I looked up at the sky. It was a clear summer night, without a single cloud. Beyond the low hill to the west, I could see the stars. I can still remember thinking, if it's true, then the stars will never again seem the same. Chapter 8. Next morning, in the broad light of day, the idea of space visitors somehow had lost its menace. If the disks were spaceships, at least they had shown no sign of hostility, so far as I knew. Of course, there was Mantell, but if he had been downed by some weapon on the disk, it could have been self-defense. In most cases, the saucers retreated at the first sign of pursuit. My mind was still reluctant to accept the space travel answer, in spite of the old reports. But I kept thinking of the famous aircraft designer who thought the disks were spacecraft, the airline pilots Purdy had mentioned, Blake's copilot, Chuck. Now that I recalled it, Blake had been more embarrassed than seemed called for when he told about Chuck. Perhaps he had been the one who believed the saucers were spaceships, instead of his absent copilot. After breakfast, I went over the list of sightings since June 1947. There were several saucers that actually had been described as projectile-like ships. The most famous of all was the Eastern Airlines case. It was 8:30 p.m., July 23, 1948, when an Eastern Airlines DC-3 took off from Houston, Texas, on a flight to Atlanta and Boston. The airliner captain was Clarence S. Chiles. During the war, he had been in the Air Transport Command, with the rank of lieutenant colonel. He had 8,500 flying hours. His first officer was John B. Whitted, a wartime pilot on B-29s. Both men were known in Eastern as careful, conservative pilots. It was a bright, moonlit night, with scattered clouds overhead. The DC-3 was 20 miles west of Montgomery at 2:45 a.m. when a brilliant projectile-like craft came hurtling along the airway. Chile saw it first and took it to be a jet plane. But the next instant both pilots saw that this was no jet fighter. It was heading southwest, Chile said later, exactly opposite to our course. Whatever it was, it flashed down toward us at terrific speed. We veered to the left. It veered sharply too, and passed us about 700 feet to the right. I saw then that it had no wings. The mystery ship passed on with its side, and he had a fairly close look. The thing was about 100 feet long, cigar-shaped, and wingless, he described it. It was about twice the diameter of a B-29, with no protruding fins. Captain Chile said the cabin appeared like a pilot compartment, except for its eerie brilliance. Both he and Whitted agreed it was as bright as a magnesium flare. They saw no occupants, but at their speed this was not surprising. An intense dark blue glow came from the side of the ship, Chile reported. It was later suggested by engineers that the strange glare could have come from a power plant of unusual type. It ran the entire length of the fuselage, like a blue fluorescent light. The exhaust was a red-orange flame, with a lighter color predominant around the outer edges. Both pilots said the flame extended 30 to 50 feet behind the ship. As it passed, Chiles noted a snout like a radar pole. Both he and Whitted glimpsed two rows of windows. Just as it went by, said Chiles, the pilot pulled up, as if he had seen the DC-3 and wanted to avoid it. There was a tremendous burst of flame from the rear. It zoomed into the clouds, its jet wash rocking our DC-3. Chiles' estimate of the mystery ship's speed was between 500 and 700 miles an hour. As the object vanished, Chiles went back into the cabin to check with the passengers. Most had been asleep or were drowsing. But one man confirmed that they were in their right senses. This passenger, Clarence McKelvey of Columbus, Ohio, told them and the Project Saucer team later that he had seen a brilliant streak of light flash past his window. It had gone too swiftly for him to catch any details. The AP interviewed Mr. McKelvey soon after he landed and ran the following story. Kennett Square, Pennsylvania, July 24, AP. Clarence L. McKelvey, assistant managing editor of the American Education Press, said he was the only passenger on the EEL Houston-Boston plane who was not asleep when the phantom craft was sighted. I saw no shape or form, Mr. McKelvey said. I was on the right side of the plane, and suddenly I saw this strange eerie streak out of my window. It was very intense, not like lightning or anything I had ever seen. The Columbus man said he was too startled, and the object moved too quickly for him to adjust his eyes to it. In Washington, Air Force officials insisted they could shed no light on the mystery. Out in Santa Monica, General George C. Kenney, then chief of the Strategic Air Command, declared the Air Force had nothing remotely like the ship described. I wish we did, General Kenney told reporters. I'd sure like to see that. The publicized story of this spaceship set off another scare, also the usual cracks about screwball pilots. But Chili's and Whitted were not screwballs, they were highly respected pilots. The passengers' confirmation added weight. But even if all three had been considered deluded, the Air Force investigators could not get around the reports from Robins Air Force Base. Just about 1 hour before the DC-3 incident, a strange flaming object came racing southward through the night skies over Robins Field, at Macon, Georgia. Observers at the airbase were astounded to see what appeared to be a huge wingless craft streak overhead, trailing a varicolored exhaust. The witnesses' description tallied with those of Chili's and Whitted. The mystery ship vanished swiftly. All observers agreed that it disappeared from the line of sight just like a normal aircraft. While I was working on this case, a contact in Washington gave me an interesting tip. Within 48 hours after that eastern sighting, Air Force engineers rushed out blueprint plans and elevations of the spaceship, based on what the two pilots told them. Whether or not this was true, I found that the Air Force engineers did compute the probable speed and lift of the mystery craft. The ship was found to be within the bounds of aerodynamic laws for operations in our atmosphere. Here is the Air Force statement. Application of the Prandtl theory of lift indicated that a fuselage of the dimensions reported by Chili's and Whitted could support a load comparable to the weight of an aircraft of this size at flying speeds in the subsonic range. This supports Chili's estimate of 500 to 700 mph. 4 days after the spaceship story was published, a Navy spokesman was quoted as hinting it might have been a high atmosphere rocket gone astray from the proving grounds in New Mexico. The brief report appeared on the editorial page of the Washington Star on July 28, 1947. It ran as follows. The Navy says that naval technicians have been testing a 3,000-mile-per-hour rocket in New Mexico. If one went astray, it could travel across our continent in a short time. At first glance I thought this might be the real answer to the Chili's Whitted case. But after a few minutes I saw it was almost impossible. First, rockets at White Sands are launched and controlled with utmost care. There have been no reported cases of such a long-distance runaway. Second, if such a rocket had gone astray, it would certainly have caused wild confusion at White Sands until they found where it landed. Hundreds of people would have known about it. The story would be certain to leak out. Third, such a rocket would have had to travel from White Sands to Macon, Georgia, then circle around south of this city for over 40 minutes. If it had kept on at the speed observed at Robins Field, it would have passed Montgomery long before the DC-3 reached the area. In addition, the rocket would have had to veer sharply away from the airliner, as both pilots testified, and then zoom into the clouds. No high atmosphere test rocket has automatic controls such as this would require. Page 71. And if it had gone astray from White Sands, the station's remote control would no longer be guiding it. The Eastern Airlines spaceship, then, was not just a fugitive rocket. But it could be a new type of aircraft, something revolutionary, developed in absolute secrecy. Other airline pilots had reported flying discs racing along the airways, though none that I knew of had described projectile-like objects. Chili's and Whitted insisted the mystery ship was not a disc, and the report from Robins Field agreed on this point. Man-made devices or not, it seemed fairly certain there was more than one type of saucer. The more I studied the evidence, the harder it was to believe that this was an Earth-made ship. Such a wingless rocket ship would require tremendous jet power to keep it in the air. Even our latest jet bombers could not begin to approach its performance. Going back over the Project Saucer preliminary report, I found strong evidence that the Air Force was worried. In their investigation, project teams had screened 225 military and civilian flight schedules. After 9 months, they reported that the mysterious object was no conventional aircraft. On April 27, 1949, the Air Force admitted that Project Saucer had failed to find the answer. The spaceship was officially listed as unidentified. But Wright Field is still working on it, an Air Force officer told me. Both Chiles and Whitted are responsible pilots, and McKelvey has a reputation for making careful statements. Even without the Robbins Field confirmation, no one could doubt that they saw something. The Chiles-Whitted spaceship was not the first of this type to be reported. Another wingless aircraft was sighted in August 1947 by two pilots for an Alabama flying service. It was at Bethel, Alabama, just after sunset, when a huge black wingless craft swept across their course. Silhouetted against the evening sky, it loomed larger than a C-54. The pilots saw no wings, motors, or jet exhausts. Swinging in behind the mystery ship, they attempted to follow. But at their speed of 170 mph, they were quickly outdistanced. Careful checking showed there were no other planes nearby that could have been mistaken for this strange craft. On New Year's Day, 1948, a similar rocket-shaped object was sighted at Jackson, Mississippi. It was first seen by a former Air Force pilot and his passenger, and later by witnesses on the ground. Before the pilot could begin to close in, the odd wingless ship pulled away. Speeding up from 200 to 500 mph, it swiftly disappeared. Besides these two cases, already on record, I had the tips Purdy had given me. One wingless ship was supposed to have been seen 3 or 4 days before the Chiles-Whitted sighting. Like the thing they reported, the unidentified craft was a double-deck spaceship, but moving at even higher speed. At first I ran into a stone wall trying to check this story. Then I found a lead confirming that this was a foreign report. It finally proved to be from The Hague. The tip had been right. This double-decked wingless ship had been sighted on July 20, 1948, 4 days before the Eastern case. Witnesses had reported it at a high altitude, moving at fantastic speed. While working on this report, I verified another tip. We had heard a rumor of a spaceship sighting at Clark Field, in the Philippine Islands. Although I didn't learn the date, I found that there was such a record. In the final Project Saucer report, the attempt to explain away this sighting was painfully evident. Analyzing this case, number 206, the Air Force said, "If the facts are correct, there is no astronomical explanation. A few points favor the daytime meteor hypothesis: snow-white color, speed faster than a jet, the roar, similarity to skywriting, and the time of day. But the tactics, if really performed, oppose it strenuously. The maneuvers in and out of cloud banks, turns of 180 degrees or more, possibly these were illusions, caused by seeing the object intermittently through clouds. The impression of a fuselage with windows could even more easily have been a sign of imagination." With this conjecture, Project Saucer listed the sighting as officially answered. The Hague spaceship case was unexplained. In following up the Jackson and Bethel reports, I talked with two officials in the Civil Aeronautics Administration. One of these was Charlie Plank, who handled public relations. I found that the pilots concerned had good records. CAA men who knew them discounted the hoax theory. "Charlie, there's a rumor that airline pilots have been ordered not to talk," I told Plank. "You know anything about it?" "You mean ordered by the Air Force or the companies?" he said. "The Air Force and the CAA. If the CAA's in on it, it's a top-level deal," said Charlie. "I think it's more likely the companies, with or without a nudge from the Air Force." While we were talking, an official from another agency came in. Because the lead he gave me was off the record, I'll call him Steve Barrett. I knew Steve fairly well. We were both pilots with service training. Our paths had crossed during the war, and I saw him now and then at airports around Washington. When the saucer scare first broke, Steve had been disgusted. Damn fools trying to get publicity, he snorted. The way Americans fall for a gag. Even the Air Force has got the jitters. So I was a little surprised to find he now thought the discs were real. What's all new? I asked. The radar reports, said Steve. I know of half a dozen cases where they've tracked the things. One was in Japan. The thing was climbing so fast no one believed the radarman at first. Then they got some more reports. One was up in Canada. There was a case in New Mexico, and I think a Navy destroyer tracked a saucer up in the North Atlantic. What did they find out? Said Charlie Plank. Steve shrugged. I don't know all the answers. Whatever they are, the things can go like hell. I had a hunch he was holding back. I waited until he had finished with Charlie, and then went down the hall with him. You think the saucers are guided missiles? I said. If I thought so, I wouldn't be talking, he said flatly. That's not a dig at you. But I was cleared last year for some secret electronics work, and it might be used in some way with guided missiles. I didn't know that, Steve. It's okay, he said. I don't mind talking, because can't believe the saucers are guided missiles. Maybe few of the things sighted out in the southwest have been our test rockets, but that doesn't explain the radar reports in Canada and Japan. I'd already heard about a radar case in Labrador, I told Steve. He looked at me quickly. Where'd you pick that up? True passed it on to me, I said. They've had some trouble tracking the things. They maneuver so fast, said Steve. It sounds crazy, but I've been told they hit more than 10,000 miles an hour. You believe it? Well, it's not impossible. Those saucers were tracked about 50 miles up, where there's not much resistance. The elevator door opened. Steve waited until we were outside of the Commerce Building. There's one other thing that gets me, he said. Unless the radar boys are way off, some of those saucers are enormous. I just can't see a guided missile 500 feet in diameter. He stopped for a moment. I suppose this will sound screwy to you. You think they're interplanetary, I said. Steve was quickly on the defensive. I haven't bought it yet, but it's not as crazy as it sounds. Without mentioning names, I told him about the aircraft designer and the airline pilots. They're in good company, said Steve. You know the Air Institute? Sure, the Air Force School down at Montgomery. 6 months ago, I was talking with an officer who'd been instructing there. Steve looked at me, deadly serious. He told me they are now teaching that the saucers are probably spaceships. Chapter 9. 3 days after my meeting with Steve Barrett, I was on the Mainliner 300, starting a new phase of the saucer investigation. By the time I returned, I hoped to know the truth about Project Saucer. As the ship droned westward, 14,000 feet above the Alleghenies, I thought of what Steve had told me. I believed that he had told me about the radar tracking. And I was fairly sure he believed the Air Institute story. But I wasn't so certain the story itself was true. It would hardly be a gag. Steve wasn't easily taken in. It was more likely that one Institute officer, or perhaps several, believed the saucers were spacecraft and aired their personal opinions. The Institute wasn't likely to give an official answer to something that Project Saucer still declared unsolved. If it were possible to get an inside look at Project Saucer operations, I could soon tell whether it was an actual investigation or a deliberate cover-up for something else. Whichever it was, the wall of official secrecy still hid it. As a formality, I had called the Pentagon again and asked to talk with some of the project officers. As I expected, I was turned down. The only alternative was to dig out the story by talking with pilots and others who had been quizzed by project teams. I had several leads, and True had arranged some interviews for me. My first stop was Chicago, where I met an airline official and two commercial pilots. I saw the pilots first. Since they both talked in confidence, I will not use their right names. One, a Midwesterner I already knew, I'll call Pete Farrell. The other, a wartime instructor, Art Green. Pete was about 31, stocky, blue-eyed, with a pleasant, intelligent face. Art Green was a little older, a lean, sunburned, restless man with an emphatic voice. Pete had served with the Air Force during the war. He was now part owner of a flying school, also a pilot in the Air National Guard. Green was working for an air charter service we met at the Palmer House. Art Green didn't need much prompting to talk about Project Saucer. After reporting a disc seen during a West Coast ride, he had been thoroughly grilled by a Project Saucer team. They practically took me apart, he said irritably. They've got a lot of trick questions. Some of them are figured out to trip up anybody faking a story. The way they worked on me, you'd think I committed a murder. Then they tried to sell me on the idea I'd seen a balloon, or maybe a plane, with the sun shining on it when it banked. I told them to go to the devil, I knew what I saw. After 17 years, I've got enough sense to tell a ship, or a balloon when I see it. Did they believe you? I asked him. If they did, they didn't let on. Two of them acted as if they thought I was nuts. The other guy, I think he was Air Force Intelligence, acted decent. He said not to get steamed up about the Aero Medical boys. It was their job to screen out the crackpots. And on top of that, I found out later the FBI had checked up on me to find out if I was a liar or a screwball. They went around to my boss, people in my neighborhood, even the pilots in my outfit. My outfit's still razzing me. I wouldn't report another saucer if one flew through my cockpit. Pete Farrell hadn't encountered any Project Saucer teams personally, but he had some interesting angles. Some of the information had come from commercial and private pilots in the Midwest, part of it through National Guard contacts. I can tell you one thing, Pete said. Guard pilots got the same order as the Air Force. If we saw anything peculiar flying around, we were to do our damnedest to identify it. What about trying to bring one down? I've heard that was in one order. Pete hesitated for a second. Look, I told you that much because it's been in the papers. But I'm still in the Guard. I can't tell you the order itself. It was confidential. Well, I'm not in the Guard, said Art Green. He lit a cigarette, blew out the match. Why don't you look into the Gorman case? Get THC dope on that court-martial angle. I'd heard of the Gorman case, but the court-martial thing was new to me. Gorman, I recalled, was a fighter pilot in the North Dakota Air National Guard. He had a mystifying encounter with a strange, fast-moving light over Fargo Airport in the fall of 1948. That case is on my list, I told Green. But I don't remember anything about a court-martial. It wasn't in the papers. But all the pilots up that way know about it. In his report, Gorman said something about trying to ram the thing. The idea got around that Air Force orders had said to try this. Anyway, it got into the papers and Gorman almost got court-martialed. If his family hadn't had some influence in the state, the Air Force probably would have pushed it. Are you sure about this? I said. You know how those things build up. Ask Gorman, he said. Or ask some of the pilots at Fargo. Before I left them, Green double-checked my report on his sighting, which Hilton had forwarded. As in the majority of cases, he had seen just one disc. It had hovered at a very high altitude, gleaming in the sun, then had suddenly accelerated and raced off to the north. I couldn't tell its size or speed, said Green. But if it was as high as I think, it must have been pretty big. Pete told me later that Green believed the disc had been at least 20 miles high, because it was well above clouds at 30,000 feet. It's kind of hard to believe, said Pete. The thing would have to be a lot bigger than a B-29, and the speed over 2,000 miles an hour. You know what they said about the Mantell saucer, I reminded him. Some of the Godman Field people said it was at least 300 feet in diameter. I've heard it was twice that, said Pete. You know any Kentucky National Guard pilots? I asked. One or two, said Pete. But they couldn't tell me anything. It was hushed up too fast. That evening I talked with the airline official, whom I knew well enough, to call by his first name. I put it to him bluntly. Dick, if you're under orders not to talk, just tell me. FM trying to find out whether Project Saucer has muzzled airline pilots. You mean the ones who have sighted things? Perhaps, in a few cases. But most of the pilots know what happened to Captain Emil Smith on United and those Eastern pilots. They keep still so they won't be laughed at. Also, the airlines don't like their pilots to talk for publication. I've heard of several cases, I said, where Air Force intelligence is supposed to have warned pilots to keep mum. Two of the reports come pretty straight. He made a gesture. That could be. I'm not denying that airline pilots, and that includes ours, see these things all the time. They've been sighted on the Seattle-Alaska route, and between Anchorage and Japan. I know of several saucers that pilots have seen between Honolulu and the mainland. Check with Pan American, you'll find their pilots have seen them too. What happens to those reports? They go to operations, said Dick. Of course, if something really important happens, the pilot may radio the tower before he lands. Then the CAA gets word to the Air Force, and they rush some intelligence officers to quiz the pilots. If it's not too hot, they'd come from Wright Field, regular Project Saucer teams. Otherwise, they'd send the nearest intelligence officers to take over temporarily. I asked him if he had ever been in on one of these sessions. Dick said he hadn't. But a couple of pilots talked to me later. They said these Air Force men seemed quite upset about it. They pounced on everything these boys said about the thing's appearance, how it maneuvered and so on. What do your pilots think the saucers are? Dick gave me a slightly ironic grin. Why ask me? Captain Blake says you've been getting it firsthand. I wasn't pulling a fast one, I protested. We're not going to quote actual names or sources, unless people okay it. Sure, I know that, said Dick. But you've got THC answer already. Some pilots say interplanetary, some say guided missiles. A few, a very few, still think it's all nonsense, because they haven't seen any. What do you think? I don't know the answer, said Dick, but I'm positive of one thing. Either the Air Force is sitting on a big secret, or they're badly scared, because they don't know the answer. During the next week or so, I covered several northwest and mountain states. Although I was chiefly trying to find out about Project Saucer, I ran onto two sightings that were not on my list. One of these had occurred in California, at Fairfield-Suisun Air Force Base. A Seattle man who had been stationed there gave me the details. It was on the night of December 1918, with unusually high winds sweeping across the airfield. At times the gusts reached almost 70 miles an hour. Suddenly a weird ball of light flashed into view, at a height of 1,000 feet. As the men on the base watched it, astonished, the mysterious light abruptly shot skyward. In an incredibly short time, it reached an altitude of 20,000 feet and vanished. Was there any shape outlined behind the light? I asked the Seattle man. Nobody saw any, he replied. It looked just like I said, a ball of light, going like a streak. Did it leave any smoke behind it? You mean like an engine, or a jet? He shook his head. Not a thing. And it didn't make a sound, even when it shot up like that. Did you hear any guesses about it, or reports later on? Some major who didn't see it said it must have been a balloon. Anybody with brains could see that was screwy. No balloon ever went up that fast, and besides, the thing was going against the wind. The second incident occurred at Salmon Dam, Idaho, on August 13, 1947. When I heard the date, it sounded familiar. I checked my sightings file, and saw it was the same day as the strange affair at Twin Falls, Idaho. In the Twin Falls case, the disc was sighted by observers in a canyon. There was one interesting difference from the usual description. This disc was sky blue, or else its gleaming surface somehow reflected the sky, because of the angle of vision. Although it was not close to the treetops, the observers were amazed to see the trees whip violently when the disc raced overhead, as though the air was boiling from the object's swift passage. At Salmon Dam, that same day, two miners heard an odd roaring sound and stared into the sky. Several miles away, two brightly gleaming discs were circling at high speed. It was like two round mirrors whirling around the sky, one of the men was later quoted as saying. They couldn't have been any ordinary planes, not round like that. And they were going too fast. During this part of my trip, I also was told that one saucer had fallen into a mountain lake. This came to me secondhand. The lone witness was said to have rushed over to his car to get his camera as the disc approached. When it plunged toward the lake, he was so startled that he failed to snap the picture until the moment it struck. This story sounded so flimsy that I didn't bother to list it. Months later, a Washington newsman confirmed at least part of the lake story. When he first related it, I thought he had fallen for a gag. "I heard that yarn," I said. "Don't tell me you believe it?" "I come from Idaho," he told me. "And I happen to know the fellow who took the picture. Maybe it wasn't a disc, but something fell into that lake." "Did you see the picture?" "Yes, at the Pentagon." At my surprised look, he added, "That was long before they clamped down. I was talking to an Air Force officer about this lake thing, and he showed me the picture." "What did it look like?" "You couldn't tell much about it, just a big splash, and a blur where something went under. Maybe a magnifying glass would bring it out, but I didn't get a chance to try it." It was early in 1950 when he told me this. I asked at the Pentagon if this picture was in the Wright Field files, and if so, whether I could see it. My inquiries drew blank looks. No one remembered such a photograph. And even if it were in the Project Saucer files, I couldn't see it. This was more than 2 months after Project Saucer had been officially closed, and its secrets presumably all revealed. The rest of my interviews during this 1949 trip helped to round out my picture of Project Saucer operations. Some witnesses seemed afraid to talk, a few flatly refused. I found no proof of official pressure, but I frequently had the feeling that strong hints had been dropped. Though one or two witnesses showed resentment at investigators' methods, most of them seemed more annoyed at the loss of time involved. One man had been checked first by the police, then by the sheriff's office. An Air Force team had spent hours questioning him, returning the next day, and finally the FBI had made a character check. What he told me about the Air Force interrogation confirmed one of Art Green's statements. One intelligence captain tried to tell me I'd seen a weather balloon. I called up the airport and had them check on release schedules. They said next day it didn't fit any schedules around this area. Anyway, the wind wasn't right, because the thing I saw was cutting into the wind at a 45-degree angle. Other witnesses told me that investigators had suggested birds, meteors, reflections on clouds, shooting stars, and star shells as probable explanations of what they had seen. I learned of one pilot who had been startled by seeing a group of discs racing past his plane. Air Force investigators later suggested that he had flown through a flock of birds, or perhaps a cluster of balloons, on the flight back to Washington. I reread all the information the Air Force had released on Project Saucer. Suddenly a familiar phrase caught my eye. I read over the paragraph again. Preliminary study of the more than 240 domestic and 30 foreign incidents by astrophysicist Hynek indicates that an overall total of about 30% can probably be explained away as astronomical phenomena. Explained away. I went through the report line by line. On page 17 I found this. Available preliminary reports now indicate that a great number of sightings can be explained away as ordinary occurrences which have been misrepresented as a result of human errors. On page 22 I ran onto another use of the phrase. The obvious explanation for most of the spherical-shaped objects reported, as already mentioned, is that they are meteorological or similar type balloons. This, however, does not explain reports that they travel at high speed or maneuver rapidly. But saucer men point out that the movement could be explained away as an optical illusion, or actual acceleration of the balloon caused by a gas leak, and later exaggerated by observers. There are scores of possible explanations for the scores of different typed sightings reported. Explained away? It might not mean anything. It could be just an unfortunate choice of words. But suppose that the real mission of Project Saucer was to cover up something, or that its purpose was to investigate something serious, at the same time covering it up, step by step. The Project Saucer teams, then, would check on reports and simultaneously try to divert attention from the truth, suggesting various answers to explain the sightings. Back at Wright Field, analysts and intelligence officers would go over the general picture and try to work up plausible explanations, which, if necessary, could even be published. Explaining away would be one of the main purposes of project personnel. These words would probably be used in discussions of ways and means. They would undoubtedly would be used in secret official papers. And since this published preliminary report had been made up from censored secret files, the use of those familiar words might have been overlooked, since, read casually, they would appear harmless. If the report had been thrown together hastily, the use of these telltale words could be easily understood, and so could the report's strange contradictions. As an experiment, I fixed the idea firmly in mind that Project Saucer was a cover-up unit. Then I went back once more and read the items quoted above. The effect was almost startling. It was as though I were reading confidential suggestions for diverting attention and explaining away the sightings, suggestions made by project members and probably circulated for comment. Now, wait a minute, I said to myself. You may be dreaming up this whole thing. Trying to get back to a neutral viewpoint, I skimmed through the other details of project operations, as described in the report. The order creating Project Saucer was signed on December 30, 1947. The actual code name was not Saucer, but since for some reason the Air Force still has not published the name, I have followed their usage of Saucer in its place. On January 22, 1948, 2 weeks after Captain Mantell's death, the project officially began operations. Preliminary investigation at Godman Field had been done by local intelligence officers. Project Saucer was set up under the Air Material Command at Wright Field. Contracts were made with an astrophysicist, Professor Joseph Hynek, also a prominent scientist, still unidentified, and a group of evaluation experts, RAND Corporation. Arrangements were made for services by the Air Weather Service, Andrews Field, the U.S. Weather Bureau, the Electronics Laboratory, Cambridge Field Station, the AMC Aero Medical Laboratory, the Army and Navy Departments, the FBI, the Department of Commerce, Civil Aeronautics Administration, and various other government and private agencies. In addition, the services of rocket experts, guided missile authorities, space travel planners, and others, in the defense services are assigned to them, were made available as desired. Under the heading How Incidents Are Investigated, the Project Saucer report says, But the hoaxes and crank letters in reality play a small part in Project Saucer. Actually, it is a serious, scientific business of constant investigation, analysis and evaluation which thus far has yielded evidence pointing to the conclusion that much of the saucer scare is no scare at all, but can be attributed to astronomical phenomena, to conventional aerial objects, to hallucinations and to mass psychology. But the mere existence of some yet unidentified flying objects necessitates a constant vigilance on the part of Project Saucer personnel and the civilian population. Investigation is greatly stepped up when observers report incidents, as soon as possible to the nearest military installation or to headquarters, AMC, direct. A standard questionnaire is filled out under the guidance of interrogators. In each case, time, location, size and shape of object, approximate altitude, speed, maneuvers, color, length of time and sight, sound, etc., are carefully noted. This information is sent in its entirety, together with any fragments, soil photographs, drawings, etc., to headquarters, AMC. Here, highly trained evaluation teams take over. The information is broken down and filed on summary sheets, plotted on maps and graphs and integrated with the rest of the material, giving an easily comprehended overall picture. Duplicate copies on each incident are sent to other investigating agencies, including technical labs within the Air Material Command. These are studied in relation to many factors such as guided missile research activity, weather, and many others, atmospheric sounding balloon launchings, commercial and military aircraft flights, flights of migratory birds and a myriad of other considerations which might furnish explanations. Generally, the flying objects are divided into four groups. Flying discs, torpedo or cigar-shaped bodies with no wings or fins visible in flight, spherical or balloon-shaped objects and balls of light. The first three groups are capable of flight by aerodynamic or aerostatic means, and can be propelled and controlled by methods known to aeronautical engineers. As for the lights, their actions, unless they were suspended from a higher object, or were the product of hallucination, remain unexplained. Eventually, reports are sent back to Project Saucer headquarters, often marking incidents closed. The project, however, is a young one. Much of its investigation is still underway. Currently, a psychological analysis is being made by AMC's Aero Medical Laboratory to determine what percentage of incidents are probably based on errors of the human mind and senses. Available preliminary reports now indicate that a great number can be explained away as ordinary occurrences which have been misrepresented as a result of these human errors. Near the end of the last page, a paragraph summed up the report. The saucers are not a joke. Neither are they cause for alarm to the population. Many of the incidents already have answers. Meteors. Balloons. Falling stars. Birds in flight. Testing devices, etc. Some of them still end in question marks. From what I had learned on this trip, I strongly doubted the answer suggested. All but the testing devices. What did they mean by that? It could be a hint at guided missiles. They had already mentioned guided missile research activity in another spot. But if that was what lay behind this elaborate project, they would hardly be hinting at it. If the answer was space travel, then such hints made sense, they would be part of the cover-up plan. Everyone, including the Soviet Union, knew we were working on guided missiles. It would do no harm to use this as one of the myriad explanations for the flying saucers. I was still trying to figure it out when my plane let down for the landing at Washington. I had hoped by this time to know the truth about Project Saucer. Instead, it was a deeper mystery than ever. True, I had found out how they operated, outside of Wright Field. Some of the incidents had been enlightening. By now, I was certain that Project Saucer was trying hard to explain away the sightings and hide the real answer. Chapter 10. When I reached home, I found a brief letter from Ken Purdy. Dear Don, the Mantell and Eastern cases both look good. I don't see how they can brush them off. It looks more like the interplanetary answer to me, but we won't decide on treatment until we're sure. I had suggested two or three angles, if this proved the real answer. Who would be the best authority to check our disk operation theory and give us more details on directional control? I'd like to have it checked by two more engineers. Ken, next day, I dug out my copy of Bohl's interview with Dee, the famous aircraft designer. Certainly the flying saucers are possible, the designer had told Bohl. Give me enough money and I'll build you one. It might have to be a model, because the fuel would be a problem. If the saucers that have been seen came from other worlds, which isn't at all Buck Rogerish, they may be powered with atomic energy, or by the energy that produces cosmic rays, which is many times more powerful, or by some other fuel or natural force that our research hasn't yet discovered. But the circular airfoil is quite feasible. It wouldn't have the stability of the conventional airplane, but it would have enormous maneuverability. It could rise vertically, hover, descend vertically, and fly at extremely high speed, with the proper power. Don't take my word for it. Check with other engineers. Before looking up a private engineer I had in mind, I went to the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics. The NACA, the predecessor of NASA, JBH, is America's most authoritative source of aerodynamic knowledge. I knew they had already tried out disc-shaped airfoils, and I asked about this first. I found that two official NACA reports, Technical Note 539 and Report 431, discuss tests on circular and elliptical Clark Y airfoils. Both reports state that these designs were found practical. Later, I talked with one of the top engineers in the NACA without showing him D.S. sketch. I asked how a disc might operate. It could be built with variable direction jet or rocket nozzles, B said. The nozzles would be placed around the rim, and by changing their direction the disc could be made to rise and descend vertically. It could hover, fly straight ahead, and make sharp turns. Its direction and velocity would be governed by the number of nozzles operating, the power applied, and the angle at which they were tilted. They could be pointed toward the ground, rearward, in a lateral direction, or in various combinations. A disc flying level, straight ahead, could be turned swiftly to right or left by shifting the angles of the nozzles or cutting off power from part of the group. This method of control would operate in the Earth's atmosphere and also, using rocket power, in free space, where conventional controls would be useless. The method he had described was not the one which Dee had outlined. What about a rotating disc? I asked the NACA man. Suppose you had one with a stationary center and a large circular section rotating around it? The rotating part would have a camera built into it, or it would have slotted vanes. He gave me a curious look. Where did you get that idea about the camera? I told him it had come to me from True. It could be done, he said. The slotted vanes method has already been tried. There's an engineer in Glendale, California, who's built a model. His name's EWK. He gave me a few details on how a cammered, or slotted vane rotating disc might operate, then interrupted himself to ask me what I thought the saucers were. They're either interplanetary, or some secret development, I said. What do you think? The NACA has no proof they even exist, he answered. When I left the building a few minutes later, I was still weighing that statement. If the Air Force or the Navy had a secret disc device, the NACA would almost certainly know about it. The chances were that any disc-shaped missile, or new type of circular aircraft, would first have been tested in the NACA wind tunnels at Langley Field. If the saucers were interplanetary, the NACA, at least top officials, would probably have been in on any discussion of the disc's performance. Either way, the NACA's official attitude could be expected to match the Pentagon's. After lunch, I took a taxi to the office of the private engineer. Like D, he has asked that he not be quoted by name. The name I am using, Paul Riedel, will serve that purpose. Riedel is a well-known aeronautical engineer. He has worked with major aircraft companies and served as a special consultant to government agencies and the industries. He is also a competent pilot. Although I had known him several years, he refused at first to talk about the saucers. Then I realized he thought I meant to quote him. I showed him some of the material I had roughed out, and which names were omitted or changed as requested. All right, Riedel said finally. What do you want to know? Anything you can tell us. But first, your ideas on these sketches. I showed him D.S. drawings and then gave him the high points of the investigation. When I mentioned the mystery light incident at Fairfield-Suisun Air Force Base, Riedel sat up quickly. The Gorman case again. We heard about some other light cases, I said. One was at Las Vegas. I know about that one. That is, if you mean the green light, wait a minute. Riedel frowned into space for a few seconds. You say that Fairfield-Suisun sighting was on December 3rd? Then the Las Vegas sighting was only a few days later. It was the first week of the month, I'm positive. Those light reports have got me stumped, I said. A light just can't fly around by itself. And those two-foot disks, you haven't worked on the Gorman case? Asked Riedel. I told him I hadn't thought it was coming up on my schedule. Leave these sketches here, he said. Look into that Gorman sighting. Then check on our plans for space exploration. I'll give you some sources. When you get through, come on back, and we'll talk it over. The Gorman saucer dogfight had been described in newspapers. The pilot had reported chasing a swiftly maneuvering white light, which had finally escaped him. Judging from the Project Saucer preliminary report, this case had baffled all the Air Force investigators. When I met George Gorman, I found him to be intelligent, cool-headed, and very firmly convinced of every detail in his story. I had learned something about his background. He had had college training. During the war, he had been an Air Force instructor, training French student pilots. In Fargo, his home, he had a good reputation, not only for veracity, but as a businessman. Only 26, he was part owner of a construction company, and also the Fargo representative for a hardware store chain. Even knowing all this, I found it hard at first to believe some of the dogfight details. But the ground observers confirmed them. It was about 9 o'clock in the evening, October 1, 1948. Gorman, now an Air National Guard lieutenant, had been on a practice flight in an F-51 fighter. The other pilots on this practice patrol had already landed. Gorman had just been cleared by the CAA operator in the Fargo Airport Tower when he saw a fast-moving light below his circling fighter. From his altitude, 4,500 feet, it appeared to be the tail light of a swiftly flying plane. As nearly as he could tell, it was 1,000 feet high, moving at about 250 mph. Gorman called the tower to recheck his clearance. He was told the only other plane in the area was a Piper Cub. Gorman could see the Cub plainly outlined below him. There was a night football game going on, and the field was brightly lighted. But the Cub was nowhere near the strange light. As the mystery light raced above the football field, Gorman noticed an odd phenomenon. Instead of seeing the silhouette of a plane, he saw no shape at all around the light. By contrast, he could see the Cub's outline clearly. Meantime, the airport traffic controller, L.D. Jensen, had also spotted the queer light. Concerned with the danger of collision, he said later that he too thought it a plane's tail light. He trained his binoculars on it. Like Gorman, he was unable to distinguish a shape near the light. Neither could another CAA man who was with him in the tower, a Fargo resident named Manuel E. Johnson. Up in EF-51, Gorman dived on the light, which was steadily blinking on and off. As I closed in, he told Project Saucer men later, it suddenly became steady and pulled up into a sharp left turn. It was a clear white and completely round, about 6 to 8 inches in diameter. I thought it was making a pass at the tower. I dived after it and brought my manifold pressure up to 60, but I couldn't catch the thing. Gorman reported its speed at full power as 350 to 400 miles per hour. During the maneuvers that followed, both the CAA men watched from the tower. Jensen was using powerful night glasses, but still no shape was visible near the mysterious light. The fantastic dogfight continued for 20 minutes. Gorman described it in detail. When I attempted to turn with the light, I blacked out temporarily, owing to excessive speed. I am in fairly good physical condition, and I don't believe there are many, if any, pilots who could withstand the turn and speed affected by the light and remain conscious. During these sharp maneuvers, the light climbed quickly, then made another left bank. I put my 51 into a sharp turn and tried to cut it off, said Gorman. By then we were at about 7,000 feet. Suddenly it made a sharp right turn, and we headed straight at each other. Just when we were about to collide, I guess I lost my nerve. I went into a dive and the light passed over my canopy at about 500 feet. Then it made a left circle about 1,000 feet above, and I gave chase again. When collision seemed imminent a second time, the object shot straight into the air. Gorman climbed after it at full throttle. Just about this time, two other witnesses, a private pilot and his passenger, saw the fast-moving light. The pilot was Dr. A.D. Cannon, an oculist. His passenger was Aner Nelson. Dr. Cannon later told investigators the light was moving at high speed. He thought it might be a Canadian jet fighter from over the border. A careful check with Canadian air officials ruled out this answer. After landing at the airport, Dr. Cannon and Mr. Nelson again watched the light, saw it change direction and disappear. Meanwhile, Gorman was making desperate efforts to catch the thing. He was now determined to ram it, since there seemed nothing solid behind it to cause a dangerous crash. If his fighter was disabled, or if it caught fire, he could bail out. But despite the F-51's fast climb, the light still outdistanced him. At 14,000 feet, Gorman's plane went into a power stall. He made one last try, climbing up to 17,000 feet. A few moments later, the light turned in a north-northwest direction and quickly disappeared. Throughout the dogfight, Gorman noticed no deviation on his instruments, according to the Project Saucer report. Gorman did not confirm or deny this when I talked with him. But he did agree with the rest of the project statement. He did not notice any sound, odor, or exhaust trail. Gorman's remarks about ramming the light reminded me of what Art Green had said. When I asked Gorman about the court-martial rumor, he gave me a searching glance. Where did you hear that? Several places, I told him. At Chicago, in Salt Lake City, in fact, we've been hearing it all over. Well, there's nothing to it, Gorman declared. He changed the subject. Some time afterward, a Fargo pilot told me there had been trouble over the ramming story. But it wasn't Gorman's fault. Somebody else released that report to the AP. The news story didn't actually say there was an Air Force order to ram it, but the idea got around, and we heard that Washington squawked. Gorman had a pretty rough time of it for a while. Some of the newspapers razzed his story, and the Project Saucer teams really worked on him. I guess they were trying to scare him into saying he was mistaken, and it was a balloon. When I asked Gorman about this, he denied he'd had rough treatment by the project teams. Sure, they asked about 1,000 questions, and I could tell they thought it might be a hoax at first. But that was before they quizzed the others who saw it. Anybody suggest it was a balloon? I said casually. At first, they were sure that's what it was, answered Gorman. You see, there was a weather balloon released here. You know the kind, it has a lighted candle on it. The project team said I chased after that candle, and just imagined the light's maneuvers, confused it with my own movement, because of the dark. Gorman grinned. They had it just about wrapped up, until they talked to George Sanderson. He's the weather observer. He was tracking the balloon with a theodolite, and he showed them his records. The time and altitudes didn't fit, and the wind direction was wrong. The balloon was drifting in the opposite direction. Both the tower men backed him up. So that killed the weather balloon idea. The next step by Project Saucer investigators had been to look for some unidentified aircraft. This failed too. Obviously, it was only routine. The outline of a conventional plane would certainly have been seen by Gorman and the men in the tower. An astronomical check by Professor Hynek ruled out stars, fireballs, and comets, a vain hope, to begin with. The only other conventional answer, as the project report later stated, was hallucination. In view of all the testimony, hallucination had to be ruled out. Finally, the investigators admitted they had no solution. The first Project Saucer report, on April 27, 1949, left the Gorman mystery light unidentified. In the Saturday Evening Post of May 7, 1949, Sidney Shalit analyzed the Gorman case, in the second of his articles on flying saucers. Shalit suggested this solution. That Gorman had chased one of the Navy's giant cosmic ray research balloons. Each of these huge balloons is lighted, so that night flying planes will not collide with the gas bag, or the instrument case suspended below. Shalit concluded that Gorman was suffering from a combination of vertigo and confusion with the light on the balloon. As already mentioned, these huge Navy balloons are filled with only a small amount of helium before their release at Minneapolis. They then rise swiftly to very high altitudes, unless a leak develops. In Shalit's words, these balloons travel high and fast. Fargo is about 200 miles from Minneapolis. Normally, a cosmic ray research balloon would have reached a very high altitude by the time it had drifted this far. The only possible answer to its low altitude sighting would be a serious leak. If a leaking balloon had come down to 1,000 feet at Fargo, it would either have remained at that height or kept on descending. The mystery light was observed at this altitude moving at high speed. If a Cub's outline was visible against the lighted football field, the massive shape of even a partly deflated balloon would have stood out like an elephant. Even before release, the partially inflated gas bags are almost 100 feet tall. The crowd at the football game would certainly have seen such a monstrous shape above the glare of the floodlights, for the plastic balloons gleam brightly in any light rays. The two CAA men, watching with binoculars, could not possibly have missed it. For the cosmic balloon answer to be correct, this leaking gas bag would have had to rise swiftly to 17,000 feet, after a loss of helium had forced it down to 1,000. As a balloon pilot, I know this is impossible. The Project Saucer report said unequivocally. The object could outturn and outspeed the F-51, and was able to attain a much steeper climb, and to maintain a constant rate of climb far in excess of the Air Force fighter. A leaking balloon? More and more, I became convinced that Secretary Forrestal had persuaded some editors that it was their patriotic duty to conceal the answer, whatever it was. That thought had begun to worry me, because of my part in this investigation. Perhaps John Steele had been right, and we shouldn't be trying to dig out the answer. But I had already told Purdy, and he had agreed, that if national security was involved, we would drop the thing completely. By the time I had proved the balloon answer wrong, I was badly puzzled. The idea of a disembodied light was the hardest thing to swallow that I'd come across so far. And yet there were the other light reports, the strange sighting at Fairfield Susan Field, the weird green lights at Las Vegas and Albuquerque. And there was the encounter that Lieutenant H.G. Combs had had one night above Andrews Field, near Washington, D.C. This incident had occurred on November 18, 1948, 6 weeks after Gorman's experience. Combs, flying with another lieutenant named Jackson, was about to land his T-6 at 9:45 p.m. when a strange object loomed up near him. It looked like a grayish globe, and it gave off an odd, fuzzy light. Combs chased the weird object for over 10 minutes, during which it appeared to evade every move he made. Once, its speed was nearly 600 miles an hour, as closely as he could estimate. In a final attempt to identify it, Combs zoomed the T-6 up at a steep angle, and flashed his landing lights on it. Before he could get a good look, the globe light whirled off to the east and vanished. Since Combs' story had been in the newspapers, Project Saucer evidently had felt unwise to give some explanation. When I read it, in the preliminary report, I was amazed. Here was the concluding sentence. The mystery was cleared up when the object was identified positively as a cluster of cosmic ray research balloons. Even one of the giant balloons would have been hard to take as the explanation. Combs was almost sure to have collided with it in his head-on passes. But an entire cluster. I tried to picture the T-6 zooming and twisting through the night sky, with several huge balloons in its path. It would be a miracle if Combs got through without hitting one of them, even if each balloon was lighted. But he had seen only one light, so had Lieutenant Jackson. That would mean all the rest of the balloons were unlighted, an unbelievable coincidence. It was not until months afterward that I found Project Saucer had withdrawn this solution. In its final report, this case, number 207, was listed in the unidentified group. How the balloon cluster explanation ever got into the first report is still a mystery. When I talked with Gorman, I told him I was baffled by the idea of a light maneuvering through the skies with no airfoil to support it. I know, he said. It got me too, at first. You mean you know the answer? I demanded. It's just my personal opinion, said Gorman. But I'd rather not have it printed. You see, I got some ideas from all the questions those project teams asked me. If my hunch turns out to be right, I might be talking about an official secret. I tried to pry some hint out of him, but Gorman just smiled and shook his head. I can tell you this much, he said, because it's been mentioned in print. There was thought behind every move the light made. It wasn't any radar responder gadget making it veer away from my ship. How do you know that? Because it reacted differently at different times. If it had been a mechanical control, it would have turned, or climbed the same way each time I got near it. Instead, it was as if some intelligent mind was directing every turn like a game of chess, and always one move ahead of me. Maybe you can figure out the rest. That was all I could get out of him. It bothered me, because Combs' report indicated the same thing. I had a strong temptation to skip the space plans research and tell Riedel what Gorman had told me. But Riedel had an orderly mind, and he didn't like to be pushed. Reluctantly, I gave up the idea. I had a feeling Riedel knew the answer to the mystery lights, and it wasn't easy to put off the solution. The letter that came from Art Green, while I was working on the space plans, didn't make it easier. Dear Kehoe, just heard about your Seattle visit. That Fairfield Susan thing is on the level. Several Air Force pilots have told me about it. When you get to Fargo, ask Gorman what they found when they checked his ship with a G-Ger counter. If he says it was negative, then he must be under orders. I happen to know better. Yours, Art Green. Chapter 11. My first step in checking on our space plans was to look up official announcements. I found that on December 29, 1948, Defense Secretary James Forrestal had released this official statement. The Earth Satellite Vehicle Program, which is being carried out independently by each military service, has been assigned to the Committee on Guided Missiles for coordination. To provide an integrated program, the committee has recommended that current efforts be limited to studies and component design. Well-defined areas of such research have been allocated to each of the three military departments. Appropriation bills had already provided funds for space exploration plans. The Air Force research was indicated by General Curtis E. Lemay, who was then Deputy Chief of Air Staff for Research and Development. In outlining plans for an Air Engineering Design Center at Wright Field, General Lemay included these space exploration requisites: flight and survival equipment for ultra-atmospheric operations, including space vehicles, space bases, and devices for use therein. The idea of exploring space is, of course, nothing new. For many years, writers of imaginative fiction have described trips to the moon and distant planets. More recently, comic books and strips have gone in heavily for space travel adventures. As a natural result of this, the first serious rocket experiments in this country were labeled screwball stunts, about on the par with efforts to break through the sonic barrier. The latter had been proved impossible by aeronautical engineers. As for rocket flight, it was too silly for serious consideration. Pendray, Goddard, and other rocket pioneers took some vicious ridicule before America woke up to the possibilities. Meantime, German scientists had gone far ahead. Their buzz bomb, a low-altitude semi-guided missile, was just the beginning. Even the devastating V-2, which soared high into the stratosphere before falling on England, was just a step in their tremendous space program. If the Nazis could have hung on a year or two more, the war might have had a grimly different ending. When the Allies seized Nazi secrets, some of the German plans were revealed. Among them was one for a huge Earth satellite. From this base, which would circle the Earth some 500 miles away, enormous mirrors would focus the sun's rays on any desired spot. The result? Swift, fiery destruction of any city or base refusing to surrender. First publication of this scheme brought the usual jeers. Many people, including some reputable scientists, believed it had been just a propaganda plan that even Goebbels had discarded as hopeless. Then the Pentagon announced the U.S. Earth Satellite Vehicle Program, along with plans for a moon rocket. The artificial satellite is to be a large rocket-propelled projectile. In its upward flight, it will have to reach a speed of 23,000 miles an hour to escape the Earth's pull of gravity. At a height of about 500 miles, special controls will turn the projectile and cause it to circle the Earth. These controls will be either automatic or operated from the ground by radar. Theoretically, once such a vehicle is beyond gravity's magnetism, it can coast along in the sky forever. Its rocket power will be shut off. The only need for such power would be if the satellite veered off course. A momentary burst from the jets would be sufficient to bring it back to its orbit. Circling the Earth in about 2 hours, this first satellite is expected to be used as a testing station. Instruments will record and transmit vital information to the Earth, the effect of cosmic rays, solar radiation, fuel required for course corrections, and many other items. A second space base farther out will probably be the next step. It may be manned, or it may be under remote control like the first. Perhaps the first satellite vehicle will be followed by a compartmented operating base, a sort of aerial aircraft carrier, with other rocket ships operating to and fro on the Earth shuttle. The moon rocket is expected to add to our information about space, so that finally we will emerge with an interplanetary spacecraft. The first attempts may fail. The first satellite may fall back and have to be guided to an ocean landing, or its controls might not bring it into the planned orbit. In this case, It could coast on out into space and be lost. But sooner or later, effective controls will be found. Then the manned spaceships will follow. Once in free space, there will be no gravitational pull to offset. The spaceship, and everything in it, will be weightless. Shielding is expected to prevent danger from cosmic rays and solar radiation. The danger from meteorites has been partly discounted in one scientific study. Probability that a meteorite will hit or penetrate a body situated in the vicinity of the Earth, by G. Grimminger, Journal of Applied Physics, Vol. 19, Number 10, pages 947-956, October 1948. In this study, it is stated that a meteorite is unlikely to penetrate the thick shell our space vehicles will undoubtedly have. However, this applies only to the Earth's atmosphere. Longer studies, using remote-controlled vehicles in space, may take years before it will be safe to launch a manned spaceship. Radar or other devices may have to be developed to detect approaching meteorites at a distance, and automatically change a spaceship's course. The change required would be infinitesimal, using power for only a fraction of a second. But before we are ready for interplanetary travel, we will have to harness atomic power, or some other force not now available, such as cosmic rays. Navigation at such tremendous speeds is another great problem, on which special groups are now at work. A Navy scientific project recently found that strange radio signals are constantly being sent out from a hot spot in the Milky Way. Other nebulae or hot stars may be similarly identified by some peculiarity in their radio emanations. If so, these could be used as checkpoints in long-range space travel. Escape from the Earth's gravity is possible even now, according to Francis H. Clauser, an authority on space travel plans. But the cost would be prohibitive, with our present rocket motors, and practical operations must wait for higher velocity rocket power, atomic or otherwise. Flight beyond the Earth's atmosphere, SAE Quarterly Transactions, Vol. 2, No. 4, October 1948. Already, a two-stage rocket has gone more than 250 miles above the Earth. This is the V-2 Walk Corporal combination. The V-2 rocket is used to power the first part of the flight, dropping off when its fuel is exhausted. The Walk Corporal then proceeds on its own fuel, reaching a fantastic speed in the thin air higher up. Hundreds of technical problems must be licked before the first satellite vehicle can be launched successfully. Records on our V-2 rockets indicate some of the obstacles. On the takeoff, their present swift acceleration would undoubtedly kill anyone inside. When re-entering the Earth's atmosphere, the nose of a V-2 gets red hot. Both the acceleration and deceleration must be controlled before the first volunteers will be allowed to hazard their lives in manned rockets. Willie Lee, noted authority on space travel problems, believes that pilots may have to accept temporary blackout as a necessity on the takeoff. Two of his books, Rockets and Space Travel and Outer Space, give fascinating and well-thought-out pictures of what we may expect in years to come. Some authorities believe that our space travel will be confined to our own solar system for a long time, perhaps forever. The trip to the moon, though now a tremendous project, would be relatively simple compared with a journey outside our system. Escape from the moon, for the return trip, would be easier than leaving the Earth. Because of its smaller mass, to escape the moon's gravitational pull would take a speed of about 5,000 miles an hour, against 23,000 for the Earth. Navigation would be much simpler. Our globe would loom up in the heavens, much larger and brighter than the moon appears to us. Radar beams would also be a guide. The greatest obstacle to reaching far distant planet is the time required. In the Project Saucer study of space travel, Wolf 359 was named as the nearest star likely to have possibly inhabited areas. Wolf 359 is 8 light-years from the Earth. The limiting speed in space, according to Einstein's law, would be just under the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second. At this speed, Einstein states, matter is converted into energy. It is a ridiculous assumption, but even if atomic power, or some force such as cosmic rays, made an approach to that speed possible, it would still take 8 years to reach Wolf 359. The round trip would take 16. There have been a few scientists who dispute Einstein's law, though no one has disproved it. If the speed of light is not an absolute limit for spaceships, then travel to remote parts of the universe may someday be possible. Otherwise, a trip outside our solar system could be a lifetime expedition. Most space travel would probably be limited to the planets of our Sun, the Moon, Mars, Venus, Jupiter, and the others. Although it may be many years before the first manned spaceship leaves the Earth, we are already at work on the problems the crews would face. I learned some of the details from a Navy flight surgeon with whom I had talked about takeoff problems. They're a lot further than that, he told me. Down at Randall Field, the Aero Medical Research Lab has run into some mighty queer things. Ever hear of dead distance? No, that's a new one. Well, it sounds crazy, but they figured out that a spaceship would be going faster than anyone could think. But you think instantaneously, I objected. Oh, no. It takes a fraction of a second, even for the fastest thinker. Let's say the ship was making 100 miles a second, and that's slow compared with what they expect eventually. Everything would happen faster than your nerve impulses could register it. Your comprehension would always be lagging a split second behind the spaceship's operation. I don't see why that's so serious, I said. Suppose radar or some other device warned you a meteorite was coming toward you head-on. Or maybe some instrument indicated an error in navigation. By the time your mind registered the thought, the situation would have changed. Then all the controls would have to be automatic, I said. I told him that I had heard about plans for avoiding meteorites. Electronic controls would be faster than thought. That's probably the answer, he agreed. Of course, at 100 miles a second it might not be too serious. But if they ever get up to speeds like 1,000 miles a second, that mental lag could make an enormous difference, whether it was a meteorite heading toward you, or a matter of navigation. One of the problems he mentioned was the lack of gravity. I had already learned about this. Once away from the Earth's pull, objects in the spaceship would have no weight. The slightest push could send crewmen floating around the sealed compartment. Suppose you spilled a cup of coffee, said the flight surgeon. What would happen? I said I hadn't thought it out. The Randall Field Lab can tell you, he said. The coffee would stay right there in the air. So would the cup, if you let go of it. But there's a more serious angle, your breath. You'd have artificial air, I began. Yes, they've already worked that out. But what about the breath you exhale? It contains carbon dioxide, and if you let it stay right there in front of your face, you'd be sucking it back into your lungs. After a while, it would asphyxiate you. So the air has to be kept in motion, and besides that, the ventilating system has to remove the carbon dioxide. What about eating? I asked. Swallowing is partly gravity, isn't it? He nodded. Same as drinking, though the throat muscles help force the food down. I don't know the answer to that. In fact, everything about the human body presents a problem. Take the blood circulation. The amount of energy required to pump blood through the veins would be almost negligible. What would that do to your heart? I couldn't even guess, I said. Well, that's all the Aero Medical Lab can do, guess at it. They've been trying to work out some way of duplicating the effect of zero gravity, but there's just no answer. If you could build a machine to neutralize gravity, you could get all the answers, except to the dead distance question. For instance, there's the matter of whether the human body would even function without gravity. All down through the stages of evolution, man's organs have been used to that downward pull. Take away gravity, and your whole body might stop working. Some of the aeromedical men I've talked with don't believe that, but they admit that long trips outside of gravity might have odd effects. Then there's the question of orientation. Here on Earth, orienting yourself depends on the feeling you get from the pull of gravity, plus your vision. Just being blindfolded is enough to disorient some people. Taking away the pull of gravity might be a lot worse. And of course out in space your only reference points would be distant stars and planets. We've been used to locating stars from points on the Earth, where we know their position. But how about locating them from out in space, with a ship moving at great speed? Inside the spaceship, it would be something like being in a submarine. Probably only the pilot compartment would have glass ports, and those would be covered except in landing, maybe even then. Outside vision might be by television, so you couldn't break a glass port and let out your pressure. But to go back to the submarine idea, it would be like a sub, with this big difference. In the submarine you can generally tell which way is down, except maybe in a crash dive, when you may lose your equilibrium for a moment. But in the spaceship, you could be standing with your feet on one spot, and another crewman might be, relative to you, standing upside down. You might be floating horizontally, the other man vertically. Page 105. The more you think about it, the crazier it gets. But they've got to solve all those problems before we can tackle space. To make sure I had the details right, I checked on the Air Force research. I found that the Randall Field Laboratory is working on all these problems, and many more. Although plans are not far enough advanced to make it certain, probably animals will be sent up in research rockets to determine the effect of no gravity before any human beings make such flights. The results could be televised back to the Earth. All through my checkup on space exploration plans, one thing struck me. I met no resistance. There was no official reticence about the program. On the contrary, nothing about it seemed secret. Even though it was peacetime, this was a little curious, because of the potential war value of an Earth satellite vehicle. Even if the Nazi scheme for destruction proved just a dream, an orbiting space base could be used for other purposes. In its 2-hour swing around the Earth, practically all of the globe could be observed directly by powerful telescopes, or indirectly by a combination of radar and television. Long-range missiles could be guided to targets after being launched from some point on the Earth. As the missiles climbed high into the stratosphere, the satellite's radar could pick them up and keep them on course by remote control. There were other possibilities for both attack and defense. Ordinarily, projects with wartime value are kept under wraps, or at least not widely publicized. Of course, the explanation might be very simple. The completion of the satellite vehicle was so remote that there seemed no need for secrecy. But in that case, why had the program been announced at all? If the purpose had been propaganda, it looked like a weak gesture. The Soviets would not be greatly worried by a dream weapon 40 or 50 years off. Besides that, the Pentagon, as a rule, doesn't go for such propaganda. There was only one conventional answer that made any sense. If we had heard that the Soviets were about to announce such a program as a propaganda trick, it would be smart to beat them to it. But I had no proof of any such Russian intention. The date on Secretary Forrestal's coordination announcement was December 30, 1948. One day later, the order creating Project Saucer had been signed. That didn't prove anything. Winding up the year, Forrestal could have signed 100 orders. I was getting too suspicious. At any rate, I had now analyzed the Gorman case and checked on our space plans. Tomorrow I would see Riedel and find out what he knew. Chapter 12. When I called Riedel's office, I found he had flown to Dallas, and would not be back for 2 days. By the time he returned, I had written a draft of the Gorman case, with my answer to the balloon explanation. When I saw him, the next morning, I asked him to look it over. Riedel lighted his pipe, and then read the draft, nodding to himself now and then. I think that's correct analysis, he said when he finished. That was a very curious case. You know, Project Saucer even had psychiatrists out there. If Gorman had been the only witness, I think they'd have called it a hallucination. As it was, they took a crack at him, and the CAA men in their preliminary report. Though I recalled that there had been a comment, I didn't remember the wording. Riedel looked it up, and read it aloud. From a psychological aspect, the Gorman incident raised the question, is it possible for an object without appreciable shape or known aeronautical configuration, to appear to travel at variable speeds and maneuver intelligently? Hallucination might sound like a logical answer, I said, until you check all the testimony. But there are just too many witnesses who confirm Gorman's report. Also, he seems like a pretty level-headed chap. Riedel filled his pipe again. But you still can't quite accept it? I'm positive they saw the light, but what the devil was it? How could it fly without some kind of airfoil? Maybe it didn't. You remember Gorman described an odd fuzziness around the edge of the light? It's in this Air Force report. That could have been a reflection from the airfoil. Yes, but Gorman would have seen any solid, I stopped, as Riedel made a negative gesture. It could be solid, and still not show up, he said. You mean it was transparent? Sure, that would do it. Let's say the airfoil was a rotating plastic disc, absolutely transparent. The blurred, fuzzy look could have been caused by the whirling disc. Neither Gorman nor the CAA men in the tower could possibly see the disc itself. Paul, I think you've hit it, I said. I can see THC rest of it. The thing was under remote control, radio, or radar. And from the way it flew rings around Gorman, whoever controlled it must have been able to see the F-51, either with a television eye or by radar, or by some means we don't understand, said Riedel. He went on carefully, in all these saucer cases, keep this in mind. We may be dealing with some totally unknown principle, something completely beyond our comprehension. For a moment, I thought he was hunting at some radical discovery by Soviet, captured Nazi scientists. Then I realized what he meant. You think they're interplanetary, I murmured. Why not? Riedel looked surprised. Isn't that your idea? I got that impression. Yes, but I didn't think you believed it. When you said to check on our space plans, I thought you had some secret missile in mind. No, I had another reason. I wanted you to see all the problems involved in space travel. If you accept the interplanetary answer, you have to accept this too. Whoever is looking us over has licked all those problems years ago. Technically, they'd be hundreds of years ahead of us, maybe thousands. It has a lot to do with what they'd be up to here. When I mentioned the old sighting reports, I found that Riedel already knew about them. He was convinced that the Earth had been under observation a long time, probably even before the first recorded sightings. I know some of those reports aren't authentic, he admitted. But if you accept even one report of a flying disc or rocket-shaped object before the 20th century, then you have to accept the basic idea. In the last 40 years, you might blame the reports on planes and dirigibles. But there was no propelled aircraft until 1903. Page 109. Either all those early sightings were wrong, or some kind of fast aerial machine has been flying periodically over the Earth for at least 2 centuries. I told him I was pretty well convinced, but that crew faced a problem. There was some conflicting evidence, and part of it seemed linked with guided missiles. I felt sure we could prove the space travel answer, but we had to stay clear of discussing any weapons that were still a secret. I can't believe that guided missiles are the answer to the Godman Field saucer and the Chili's Witted case, or this business at Fargo. But we're got to be absolutely sure before we print anything. Well, let's analyze it, said Riedel. Let's see if all the saucers could be explained as something launched from the Earth. He reached for a pad and a pencil. First, let's take your rotating disk. That would be a lot simpler to build than a stationary disk with variable jet nozzles. With a disk rotated at high speed, you get a tremendous lift, whether it's slotted or cammered, as long as there's enough air to work on. The helicopter principle, I said. Riedel nodded. The most practical propulsion would be with two or more jets out on the rim, to spin your rotating section. But to get up enough speed for the jets to be efficient, you'd have to whirl the disk mechanically before the takeoff. Here's one way. You could have a square hole in the center, then the disk launching device would have a square shaft, rotated by an engine or a motor. As the speed built up, the camera disk would ride up the shaft and free itself, rising vertically, with the jets taking over the job of whirling the cammered section. The lift would be terrific, far more than any normal aircraft. I don't believe any human being could take the G's involved in a maximum power climb. They'd have to use remote control. When it got to the desired altitude, your disk could be flown in any direction by tilting it that way. The forward component from that tremendous lift would result in a very high speed. The disk could also hover and descend vertically. What about maneuvering? I asked, thinking of Gorman's experience. It could turn faster than any pilot could stand, said Riedel. Of course, a pilot's cockpit could be built into a large disk, but there'd have to be some way of holding down the speed, to avoid too many G's and tight maneuvers. Most of the disks don't make any noise, I said. At least, that's the general report. You'd hear ordinary jets for miles. Right, and here's another angle. Ramjets take a lot of fuel. Even with some highly efficient new jet, I can't see the long ranges reported. Some of these saucers have been seen all over the world. No matter which hemisphere they were launched from, they'd need an 8,000-mile range, at least, to explain all of the sightings. The only apparent answer would be some new kind of power, probably atomic. We certainly didn't have atomic engines for aircraft in 1947, when the first disks were seen here. And we don't have them now, though we're working on it. Even if we had such an engine, it wouldn't be tiny enough to power the small disks. Anyway, I said, we'd hardly be flying them all over everywhere. The cost would be enormous, and there'd always be a danger of somebody getting the secret if a disk landed. Plus the risk of injuring people by radiation. Just imagine an atomic-powered disk dropping into a city. The whole idea's ridiculous. That seems to rule out the guided missile answer, I began. But Riedel shook his head. Disk-shaped missiles are quite feasible. I'm talking about range, speed, and performance. Imagine for a moment that we have disk-type missiles using the latest jet or rocket propulsion, either piloted or remote-controlled. The question is, could such disks fit specific sightings like the one at Godman Field and the case at Fargo? Riedel paused as if some new thought had struck him. Wait a minute, here's an even better test. I happen to know about this case personally. Marvin Miles, he's an aviation writer in Los Angeles, was down at White Sands Proving Ground some time ago. He talked with a Navy rocket expert who was in charge of naval guided missile projects. This Navy man, he's a commander in the regular service, told Miles they'd seen four saucers down in that area. You're sure he wasn't kidding, Miles? I said. Then I remembered Purdy's tip about a White Sands case. I told you I checked on this myself, Riedel said, a little annoyed. After Miles told me about it, I asked an engineer who'd been down there if it was true. He gave me the same story, figures and all. The first saucer was tracked by White Sands observers with a theodolite. Then they worked out its performance with ballistics formulas. Riedel looked at me grimly. The thing was about 50 miles up, and it was making over 15,000 miles an hour. One of the witnesses, said Riedel, was a well-known scientist from the General Mills Aeronautical Research Laboratory in Minneapolis, which was working with the Navy. A few days later, I verified this fact and the basic details of Riedel's account. But it was not until early in January 1950 that I finally identified the officer as Commander Robert B. McLaughlin, and got his dramatic story. Here are two more items Miles told me, Riedel went on. This Navy expert said the saucer actually looked elliptical, or egg-shaped. And while it was being tracked, it suddenly made a steep climb, so steep no human being could have lived through it. One thing is certain, I said. That 50-mile altitude knocks out the rotating disk. Up in that thin air it wouldn't have any lift. Right, said Riedel. And the variable jet type would require an enormous amount of fuel. Regardless, those G's mean it couldn't have had any pilot born on this Earth. According to Marvin Miles, this white sand saucer had been over 100 feet long. Later, Commander McLaughlin stated that it was 105 feet. If this were an American device, then it meant that we had already licked many of the problems on which the Earth satellite vehicle designers were supposed to be just starting. Their statements, then, would have to be false, part of an elaborate cover-up. If we had such an advanced design, said Riedel, and I just don't believe it possible, would we gamble on a remote control system? No such system is perfect. Suppose it went wrong. At that speed, over 15,000 miles an hour, your precious missile or strato ship could be halfway around the globe in about 45 minutes. That is, if the fuel held out. Before you could regain control, you might lose it in the sea. Or it might come down behind the Iron Curtain. Even if it were I smashed to bits, it would tip off the Soviets. They might claim it was a guided missile attack. Almost anything could happen. It could have a time bomb in it, I suggested. If it got off course, or out of control, it would blow itself up. Riedel emphatically shook his head. I've heard that idea before, but it won't hold up. What if your ship's controls went haywire, and the thing blew up over a crowded city? Imagine the panic, even if no actual damage was done. No, sir, nobody in his right mind is going to let a huge ship like that go barging around unpiloted. It would be criminal negligence. If the White Sands calculations were correct, then this particular saucer was no Earth-made device. Perhaps in coming years, we could produce such a ship, with atomic power to drive it. But not now. Riedel went over several other cases. Take the Godman Field saucer. At one time, it was seen at places 175 miles apart, as you know. Even to have been seen at all from both places, it would have to have been huge, much larger than 250 feet in diameter. The human eye wouldn't resolve an object that size, at such a distance and height. It was an odd thing. I had gone over the mantle case a dozen times. I knew the object was huge. But I had never tried to figure out the object's exact size. How big do you think it was? I asked quickly. This could be the key I had tried to find. I haven't worked it out, said Riedel. But I can give you a rough idea. The human eye can't resolve any object that subtends less than 3 minutes of arc. For instance, a plane with a 100-foot wingspan would only be a speck 20 miles away, if you saw it at all. But this thing was seen clearly 87 miles away, or even more, if it wasn't midway between the two cities. Why, it would have to be 1,000 feet in diameter. Even larger. Riedel was silent a moment. What was the word Mantle used? Tremendouses? I tried to visualize the thing, but my mind balked. One thing was certain now. It was utterly impossible that any nation on Earth could have built such an enormous airborne machine. Just to think of the force required to hold it in the sky was enough to stagger any engineer. We were years away, perhaps centuries, from any such possibility. As if he had read my thoughts, Riedel said soberly, "There's no other possible answer. It was a huge spaceship, perhaps the largest ever, to come into our atmosphere." It was clear now why such desperate efforts had been made to explain away the object Mantell had chased. "What about that Eastern Airlines sighting?" I asked. "Well, first," said Riedel, "it wasn't any remote control guided missile. I'll say it again, it would be sheer insanity. Suppose that thing had crashed in Macon. At that speed it could have plowed its way for blocks, right through the buildings. It could have killed hundreds of people, burned the heart out of the city. If it was a missile, or some hush-hush experimental job, then it was piloted. But they don't test a job like that on any commercial airways. And they don't fool around at 5,000 feet, where people will see the thing streaking by and call the newspapers. To power a 100-foot wingless ship, especially at those speeds, would take enormous force. Not as much as a V-2 rocket, but tremendous power. The fuel load would be terrific. Certainly, the pilot wouldn't be circling around Georgia and Alabama for an hour, buzzing airliners. I'll stake everything that we couldn't duplicate that spaceship's performance for less than $50 million. It would take something brand new in jets." Riedel paused. He looked at me grimly. "And the way I'd have to soup it up, it would be a damn dangerous ship to fly. No pilot would deliberately fly it that low. He'd stay up where he'd have a chance to bail out." I told him what I had heard about the blueprints the Air Force was said to have rushed. "Of course they were worried," said Riedel. "And probably they still are. But I don't think they need be. So far, there's been nothing menacing about these spaceships." When I got him back to the Gorman case, Riedel drew a sketch on his pad, showing me his idea of the disk light. He estimated the transparent rim was not more than 5 feet in diameter. "Possibly smaller," he said. "You recall that Gorman said the light was between 6 and 8 inches in diameter. He also said it seemed to have depth, that was in the Air Force report. You think all the mechanism was hidden by the light?" "Only possible answer," said Riedel. "But just try to imagine crowding a motor, or jet controls for rim jets, along with remote controls and a television device, in that small space. Plus your fuel supply. I don't know any engineer who would even attempt it. To carry that much gear, it would take a fair-sized plane. You could make a disc large enough, but the mechanism and fuel section would be 2 or 3 feet across, at least. So Gorman's light must have been powered and controlled by some unique means. The same principle applies to all the other light reports I've heard. No shape behind them, high speed, and intelligent maneuvers. That thing was guided from some interplanetary ship, hovering at a high altitude," Riedel declared. "But I haven't any idea what source of power it used. Until then, I had forgotten about Art Green's letter. I told Riedel what Art had said about the Giger counter. I knew they went over Gorman's fighter with a Giger counter," Riedel commented. "But they said the reaction was negative. If Green is right, it's interesting. It would mean they have built incredibly small atomic engines. But with a race so many years ahead of us, it shouldn't be surprising. Of course, they may also be using some other kind of power our scientists say is impossible." I was about to ask him what he meant when his secretary came in. "Mr. Carson is waiting," she told Riedel. "He had a 4 o'clock appointment." As I started to leave, Riedel looked at his calendar. "I hate to break this up. It's a fascinating business. What about coming in Friday? I'd like to see the rest of those case reports." "Fine," I said. "I've got a few more questions too." Going out, I made a mental note of the Friday date. Then the figure clicked. It was just 3 months since I'd started on this assignment. 3 months ago. At that time I'd only been half sure that the saucers were real. If anyone had said I'd soon believe they were spaceships, I'd have told him he was crazy. Chapter 13. Before my date with Riedel, I went over all the material I had, hoping to find some clue to the space visitor's planet. It was possible, of course, that there was more than one planet involved. Project Saucer had discussed the possibilities in it, report of April 27, 1949. I read over this section again. Since flying saucers first hit the headlines almost 2 years ago, there has been wide speculation that the aerial phenomena might actually be some form of penetration from another planet. Actually, astronomers are largely in agreement that only one member of the solar system beside Earth is capable of supporting life. That is Mars. Even Mars, however, appears to be relatively desolate and inhospitable, so that a Martian race would be more occupied with survival than we are on Earth. On Mars, there exists an excessively slow loss of atmosphere, oxygen and water, against which intelligent beings, if they do exist there, may have protected themselves by scientific control of physical conditions. This might have been done, scientists speculate, by the construction of homes and cities underground, where the atmospheric pressure would be greater, and thus temperature extremes reduced. The other possibilities exist, of course, that evolution may have developed a being who can withstand the rigors of the Martian climate, or that the race, if it ever did exist, has perished. In other words, the existence of intelligent life on Mars, where the rare atmosphere is nearly devoid of oxygen and water, and where the nights are much colder than our Arctic winters, is not impossible, but is completely unproven. The possibility of intelligent life also existing on the planet Venus is not considered completely unreasonable by astronomers. The atmosphere of Venus apparently consists mostly of carbon dioxide with deep clouds of formaldehyde droplets, and there seems to be little or no water. Yet, scientists concede that living organisms might develop in chemical environments which are strange to us. Venus, however, has two handicaps. Her mass and gravity are nearly as large as the Earth. Mars is smaller, and her cloudy atmosphere would discourage astronomy, hence space travel. The last argument, I thought, did not have too much weight. We were planning to escape the Earth's gravity. Martians could do the same with their planet. As for the cloudy atmosphere, they could have developed some system of radio or radar investigation of the universe. The Navy research units, I knew, were probing the far-off Crab Nebula in the Milky Way with special radio devices. This same method, or something far superior, could have been developed on Venus, or other planets surrounded by constant clouds. After the discussion of solar system planets, the Project Saucer report went on to other star systems. Outside the solar system, other stars, 22 in number, have satellite planets. Our sun has 9. One of these, the Earth, is ideal for existence of intelligent life. On 2 others there is a possibility of life. Therefore, astronomers believe reasonable the thesis that there could be at least one ideally habitable planet for each of the 22 other eligible stars. After publication of our findings in True, several astronomers said that many planets may be inhabited. One of these was Dr. Carl F. von Weizsäcker, noted University of Chicago physicist. On January 10, 1950, Dr. von Weizsäcker stated, "Billions upon billions of stars found in the heavens may each have their own planets revolving about them. It is possible that these planets would have plant and animal life on them similar to the Earth's." After narrowing the eligible stars down to 22, the Project Saucer report goes on. The theory is also employed that man represents the average in advancement and development. Therefore, one half the other habitable planets would be behind man in development, and the other half ahead. It is also assumed that any visiting race could be expected to be far in advance of man. Thus, the chance of space travelers existing at planets attached to neighboring stars is very much greater than the chance of space-traveling Martians. The one can be viewed as almost a certainty, if you accept the thesis, that the number of inhabited planets is equal to those that are suitable for life, and that intelligent life is not peculiar to the Earth. The most likely star was Wolf 359, 8 light-years away. I thought for a minute about traveling that vast distance. It was almost appalling, considered in terms of man's lifespan. Of course, dwellers on other planets might live much longer. If the speed of light was not an absolute limit, almost any space journey would then be possible. Since there would be no resistance in outer space, it would be simply a matter of using rocket power in the first stages to accelerate to the maximum speed desired. In the latter phase, the rocket's drive would have to be reversed to decelerate for the landing. The night before my appointment with Riedel, I was checking a case report when the phone rang. It was John Steele. "Are you still working on the saucers?" he asked. "If you are, I have a suggestion, something that might be a real lead." "I could use a lead right now," I told him. "I can't give you the source, but it's one I consider reliable," said Steele. "This man says the discs are British developments." This was a new one. I hadn't considered the British. Steele talked for over half an hour, expanding the idea. The saucers, his informant said, were rotating discs with cammered surfaces, originally a Nazi device. Near the end of the war, the British had seized all the models, along with the German technicians and scientists who had worked on the project. The first British types had been developed secretly in England, according to this account. But the first tests showed a dangerous lack of control. The discs streaked up to high altitudes, hurtling without direction. Some had been seen over the Atlantic, some in Turkey, Spain, and other parts of Europe. The British then had shifted operations to Australia, where a guided missile test range had been set up. This part, I knew, could be true. There was such a range. After improving their remote control system, which used both radio and radar, they had built discs up to 100 feet in diameter. These were launched out over the Pacific, the first ones straight eastward over open sea. British destroyers were stationed at 100-mile, and later 500-mile intervals, to track the missiles by radar, and correct their courses. At a set time, when their fuel was almost exhausted, the discs came down vertically, and landed in the ocean. Since part of the device was sealed, the discs would float. Then a special launching ship would hoist them abroad, refuel them, and launch them back toward a remote base in Australia, where they were landed by remote control. Since then, Steele said, the disc's range and speed had been greatly increased. The first tests of the new discs was in the spring of 1947, his informant had told him. The British had rushed the project because of Soviet Russia's menacing attitude. Their only defense in England, the British knew, would be some powerful guided missile that could destroy Soviet bases after the first attack. In order to check the range and speeds accurately, it was necessary to have observers in the Western Hemisphere. The discs were now traversing the Pacific. The ideal test range, the British decided, was one extending over Canada, where the discs could be tracked and even landed. If the account was right, said Steele, a base had been set up in the desolate Hudson Bay country. Special radar tracking stations had also been established to guide the missiles toward Australia and vessels at sea. These stations also helped to bring in missiles from Australia. Some of the disc missiles were supposed to have been launched from a British island in the South Pacific. Others came all the way from Australia. Still others were believed to have been launched by a mother ship stationed between the Galapagos Islands and Pitcairn. It was these new discs that had been seen in the United States, Alaska, Canada, and Latin America, Steele's informant had told him. At first, the sightings were due to imperfect controls. The discs sometimes failed to keep their altitude, partly because of conflicting radio and radar beams from the countries below. Responding to some of these mixed signals, Steele said, the disks had been known to reverse course, hover or descend over radar and radio stations, or circle around at high speeds until their own control system picked them up again. For this reason, the British had arranged a simple detonator system, operated either by remote control or automatically under certain conditions. In this way, no disk would crash over land, with the danger of hitting a populated area. If it descended below a certain altitude, the disk would automatically speed up its rotation, then explode at a high altitude. When radar trackers saw that a disk was off course and could not be realigned, the nearest station then sent a special signal to activate the detonator system. This was always done, Steele had been told, when a disk headed toward Siberia. There had previously been a few cases when Australian launch disks had got away from controllers and appeared over Europe. I listened to Steele's account with mixed astonishment and suspicion. It sounded like a pipe dream, but if it was, it had been carefully thought out, especially the details that followed. At first, Steele said, American defense officials had been completely baffled by the disk reports. Then the British, learning about the sightings, had hastily explained to top-level American officials. An agreement had been worked out. We were to have the benefit of their research and testing and working models, in return for helping to conceal the secret. We were also to aid in tracking and controlling the missiles when they passed over this country. And I gather we paid in other ways, Steele said. My source says this played a big part in increasing our aid to Britain, including certain atomic secrets. That could make sense. Sharing such a secret would be worth all the money and supplies we had poured into England. If America and Great Britain both had a superior long-range missile, it would be the biggest factor I knew for holding off war. But the long ranges involved in Steele's explanation made the thing incredible. How are they powered? What fuel do they use? I asked him. That's the one thing I couldn't get, said Steele. This man told me it was the most carefully guarded secret of all. They've tapped a new source of power. If he means atomic engines, I said, I don't believe it. I don't think anyone is that far along. No, no, Steele said earnestly, he said it wasn't that. And the rest of the story hangs together. Privately, I thought of two or three holes, but I let that go. If it's British, I said, do you think we should even hint at it? I don't see any harm, Steele answered. The Russians undoubtedly know the truth. They have agents everywhere. It might do a lot of good for American-British relations. Anyway, it would offset any fear that the saucers are Soviet weapons. Then you're not worried about that angle anymore? Steele laughed. No, but it had me going for a while. It was a big relief to find out the disks are British. What's the disk's ceiling? I asked, abruptly. Oh, 60,000 feet, at least, said Steele. After a moment he added quickly, that's just a guess, they probably operate much higher. I didn't think to ask. Before I hung up, he asked me what I thought of the British explanation. It's certainly more plausible than the Soviet idea, I said. I thanked him for calling me and put down the phone. I was tempted to point out the flaws in his story, but I didn't. If he was sincere, it would be poor thanks for what he had told me. If he was trying to plant a fake explanation, it wouldn't hurt to let him think I'd swallowed it. When I saw Riedel, I told him about Steele. It does look like an attempt to steer you away from the interplanetary answer, Riedel agreed, though he may be passing on the tip he believes. You think there could be any truth in the British story? Would the British risk a 100-foot disk crashing in some American city, said Riedel? No remote control is perfect, and neither is a detonator system. By some freak accident, a disk might come down in a place like Chicago, and then blow up. I just can't see the British, any more than ourselves, letting huge unpiloted missiles go barging around the world, flying along airways and over cities. Certainly, they could have automatic devices to make them veer away from airliners, but what if a circuit failed? I go along with that, I said. I don't say the British don't have some long-range missiles, Riedel broke in. Every big nation has a guided missile project. But no guided missile on Earth can explain the Mantell case and the others we've discussed. I showed him the material I had on the Nazi disk experiments. Riedel skimmed through it and nodded. I can tell you a little more, he said. Some top Nazi scientists were convinced we were being observed by space visitors. They'd searched all the old reports. Some sighting over Germany set them off about 1940. That's what I was told. I think that's where they first got the idea of trying out oval and circular airfoils. Up to then, nobody was interested. The rotation idea uses the same principle as the helicopter, but nobody had even followed that through. The Nazis went to work on the disks. They also began to rush space exploration plans, the orbiting satellite idea. I think they realized these spaceships were using some great source of power we hadn't discovered on Earth. I believe that's what they were after, that power secret. If they'd succeeded, they'd have owned the world. As it was, that space project caused them to leap ahead of everybody with rockets. When I asked Riedel how he thought the spaceships were powered, he shrugged. Probably cosmic rays hold the answer. Their power would be even greater than atomic power. There's another source I've heard mentioned, but most people scoff at it. That's the use of electromagnetic fields in space. The Earth has its magnetic field, of course, and so does the Sun. Probably all planets do. There's a man named Fernand Roussel who wrote a book called The Unifying Principle of Physical Phenomena, about 1943. He goes into the electromagnetic field theory. If he's right, then there must be some way to tap this force and go from one planet to another without using any fuel. You'd use your first planet's magnetic field to start you off, and then coast through space until you got into the field of the next planet. At least, that's how I understand it. But you'd be safer sticking to atomic power. That's been proved. Most of our conversations had been keyed to the technical side of the flying saucer problem. But before I left this time, I asked Riedel how the thought of space visitors affected him. Oh, at first I had a queer feeling about it, he answered. But once you accept it, it's like anything else. You get used to the idea. One thing bothers me, I said. When I try to picture them, I keep remembering the crazy looking things in some of the comics. What do you suppose they're really like? I've thought about it for months. Riedel slowly shook his head. I haven't the slightest idea. Chapter 14. That evening, after my talk with Riedel, the question kept coming back in my mind. What were they like? And what were they doing here? From the long record of sightings, it was possible to get an answer to the second question. Observation of the Earth followed a general pattern. According to the reports, Europe, the most populated area, had been more closely observed than the rest of the globe until about 1870. By this time, the United States, beginning to rival Europe in industrial progress, had evidently become of interest to the spaceship crews. From then on, Europe and the Western Hemisphere, chiefly North America, shared the observers' attention. The few sightings reported at other points around the world indicate an occasional checkup on the Earth in general. Apparently, World War I had not greatly concerned the space observers. One reason might be that our aerial operations were still at a relatively low altitude. But World War II had drawn more attention, and this had obviously increased from 1947 up to the present time. Our atomic bomb explosions and the V-2 high-altitude experiments might be only coincidence, but I could think of no other development that might seriously concern dwellers on other planets. It was a strange thing to think of some far-off race keeping track of the Earth's progress. If Riedel was right, it might even have started in prehistoric time. A brief survey, perhaps once a century, or even further spaced, then gradually more frequent observation as cities appeared on the Earth. Somewhere on the distant planet there would be records of that long survey. I wondered how our development would appear to that far advanced race. They would have seen the slow sailing ships, the first steamships, the lines of steel tracks that carried our first trains. Watching for our first aircraft, they would see the drifting balloons that seemed an aerial miracle when the Montgolfiers first succeeded. More than a century later, they would have noted the slow, clumsy airplanes of the early 1900s. From our gradual progress to the big planes and bombers of today, they could probably chart our next steps toward the stratosphere, and then space. During the last two centuries, they would have watched a dozen wars, each one fiercer than the last, spreading over the globe. Adding up all the things they had seen, they could draw an accurate picture of man, the Earth creature, and the increasingly fierce struggle between the Earth races. The long survey held no sign of menace. If there had been a guiding purpose of attack and destruction, it could have been carried out years ago. It was almost certain that any planet race able to traverse space would have the means for attack. More than once, during this investigation, I had been asked, if the saucers are interplanetary, why haven't they landed here? Why haven't their crews tried to make contact with us? There was always the possibility that the planet racer races could not survive on Earth, or that their communications did not include the methods that we used. But I found that hard to believe. Such a superior race would certainly be able to master our radio operations, or anything else that we had developed, in a fairly short time. And it should be equally simple to devise some means of survival on Earth, just as we were already planning special suits and helmets for existence on the moon. During a talk with a former intelligence officer, I got a key to the probable explanation. Why don't you just reverse it, list what we intend to do when we start exploring space? That'll give you the approximate picture of what visitors to the Earth would be doing. Naturally, all the details of space plans have not been worked out, but the general plan is clear. After the first successful Earth satellites, we will either attempt a space base farther out, or else launch a moon rocket. Probably many round trips to the moon will be made before going farther in space. Which planet will be explored first, after the moon? According to Air Force reports, it is almost a certainty that planets outside the solar system are inhabited. But because of the vast distances involved, expeditions to our neighboring planets may be tried before the more formidable journeys. More than one prominent astronomer believes that life, entirely different from our own, may exist on some solar planets. Besides Mars, Jupiter, and Venus, there are five more that, like the Earth, revolve around the Sun. One of the prominent authorities is Dr. H. Spencer Jones, Astronomer Royal. In his book Life on Other Worlds, Dr. Jones points out that everything about us is the result of changing processes, begun millenniums ago and still going on. We cannot define life solely in our own terms. It can exist in unfamiliar forms. It is conceivable, Dr. Jones states in his book, that we could have beings, the cells of whose bodies contain silicon instead of the carbon which is an essential constituent of our cells, and of all other living cells on the Earth. And that because of this essential difference between the constitution of those cells, and the cells of which animal and plant life on the Earth are built up, they might be able to exist at temperatures so high that no terrestrial types of life could survive. According to Dr. Jones, then, life could be possible on worlds hotter and drier than ours. It could also exist on a very much colder one, such as Mars. Even if a survey of the Sun's planets proved fruitless, it would decide the question of their being populated. Also, it would provide valuable experience for the much longer journeys into space. No one expects such a survey until we have a space vehicle able to make the round trip. One-way trips would tell us nothing, even if volunteers offered to make such suicidal journeys. The most probable step will be to launch a space vehicle equipped with supplies for a long time, perhaps a year or two, within the solar system. Since Mars has been frequently mentioned as a source of the flying saucers, let's assume it would be the first solar system planet to be explored from the Earth. As the spaceship neared Mars, it could be turned to circle the planet in an orbit, just like our planned Earth satellite vehicle. Once in this orbit, it could circle indefinitely without using fuel except to correct its course. From this space base, unmanned remote control observer units with television eyes or other transmitters would be sent down to survey the planet at close range. If it then seemed fairly safe, a manned unit could be released to make a more thorough checkup. Such preliminary caution would be imperative. Our explorers would have no idea of what awaited them. The planet might be uninhabited. It might be peopled by a fiercely barbarous race unaware of civilization as we know it. Or it might have a civilization far in advance of ours. The explorers would first try to get a general idea of the whole planet. Then they would attempt to examine the most densely populated areas, types of armature, any aircraft likely to attack them. Combing the radio spectrum, they would pick up and record sounds and signals, in order to decipher the language. As on Earth, they might hear a hodgepodge of tongues. The next step would be to select the most technically advanced nation, listen in, and try to learn its language, or record it for deciphering afterward on Earth. Our astronomers already have analyzed Mars' atmosphere, but the explorers would have to confirm their reports to find out whether the atmosphere at the surface would support their lungs if they landed. The easiest way would be to send down manned or unmanned units with special apparatus to scoop in atmosphere samples. Later analysis would tell whether Earthlings would need oxygen helmet suits such as we plan to use on the moon. But before risking flight at such low altitudes, the explorers would first learn everything possible about the planet's aircraft, if any. They would try to determine their top ceiling, maximum speed, maneuverability, and if possible their weapons. Much of this could be done by sending down remote control observer discs, or whatever type we decide to use. A manned unit might make a survey at night or in daytime with clouds nearby to shield it. By hovering over the planet's aircraft bases, the explorers could get most of the picture and also decide whether the bases were suitable for their own use later. It might even be necessary to lure some Martian aircraft into pursuit of our units to find out their performance. But our explorers would above all avoid any sign of hostility. They would hastily withdraw to show they had no warlike intentions. If the appearance of our observer units and manned craft caused too violent reactions on the planet, the explorers would withdraw to their orbiting space vehicle and either wait for a lull or else start the long trip back home. Another interplanetary craft from the Earth might take its place later to resume periodic surveys. In this way, a vast amount of information could be collected without once making contact with the strange race. If they seem belligerent or uncivilized, we would probably end our survey and check on the next possibly inhabited planet. If we found they were highly civilized, we would undoubtedly attempt later contact. But it might take a long time, decades of observation and analysis, before we were ready for that final step. We might find a civilization not quite so advanced as ours. It might not yet have developed radio and television. We would then have no way of getting a detailed picture, learning the languages, or communicating with the Martians. Analysis of their atmosphere might show a great hazard to Earthlings, one making it impossible to land, or requiring years of research to overcome. There might be other obstacles beyond our present understanding. The same procedure would apply to the rest of the solar system planets and to more distant systems. Since Wolf 359 is the nearest star outside our system that is likely to have inhabited planets, one of these planets would probably be listed as the first to explore in far distant space. It would be a tremendous undertaking unless the speed of light can be exceeded in space. Since Wolf 359 is 8 light years from the Earth, even if a spaceship traveled at the theoretical maximum, just under 186,000 miles a second, it would take over 16 years for the round trip. Detailed observation of the planet would add to this period. If we assume half that speed, which would still be an incredible attainment with our present knowledge, our space explorers would have to dedicate at least 32 years to the hazardous, lonely round trip. However, there has never been a lack of volunteers for grand undertakings in the history of man. It is quite possible that in our survey of the solar system planets we would find some inhabited, but not advanced enough, to be of interest to us. Periodically, we might make return visits to note their progress. Meantime, our astronomers would watch these planets, probably developing new, higher-powered telescopes for the purpose, to detect any signs of unusual activity. Any tremendous explosion on a planet would immediately concern us. Such an explosion, on Mars, was reported by astronomers on January 16, 1950. The cause and general effects are still being debated. Sadao Seki, the Japanese astronomer who first reported it at Osaka, believes it was of volcanic nature. The explosion created a cloud over an area about 700 miles in diameter and 40 miles high. It was dull gray with a yellowish tinge, and a different color from the atmospheric phenomena customarily seen near Mars. Seki believes the blast might have destroyed any form of life existing on the planet, but even though the telescopic camera recorded a violent explosion, other authorities do not believe the planet was wrecked. The canals first discovered on Mars by Giovanni Schiaparelli, about 1877, are still apparent on photographs. Mars is now being carefully watched by astronomers. If there are more of the strange explosions, the planet will be scanned constantly for some clue to their nature. If a mysterious explosion on Mars, or any other planet, were found of atomic origin, it would cause serious concern on Earth. Suppose for a moment that it happened many years from now, when we will have succeeded in space explorations. At this time, let us assume our explorers have found that Mars is experimenting with high-altitude rockets. Some of them have been seen, rising at tremendous speed, in the upper atmosphere of Mars. Then comes this violent explosion. A scientific analysis of the cloud by astrophysicists here on Earth proves it was of atomic origin. The first reaction would undoubtedly be an immediate resurvey of Mars. As quickly as possible, we would establish an orbiting space base, out of range of Martian rockets, and try to find how far they had advanced with atomic bombs. Samples of the Martian atmosphere would be collected and analyzed for telltale radiation. Observer units would be flown over the planet, with instruments to locate atom bomb plants and possibly uranium deposits. The rocket launching bases would also come under close observation. We would try to learn how close the scientists were to escaping the pull of gravity. Since Mars' gravity is much less than the Earth's, the Martians would not have so far to progress before succeeding in space travel. The detailed survey by our space base observers would probably show that there was no immediate danger to the Earth. It might take 100 years. Perhaps 500, before the Martians could be a problem. Eventually, the time would come when Mars would send out spaceship explorers. They would undoubtedly discover that the Earth was populated with a technically advanced civilization. Any warlike ideas they had in mind could be quickly ended by a show of our superior spacecraft and our own atomic weapons, probably far superior to any on Mars. It might even be possible that by then we would have finally outlawed war. If so, a promise to share the peaceful benefits of our technical knowledge might be enough to bring Martian leaders into line. Regardless of our final decision, we would certainly keep a loose watch on Mars, or any other planet that seemed a possible threat. Now, if our space exploration program is just reversed, it will give a reasonable picture of how visitors from space might go about investigating the Earth. Such an investigation would tie in with the general pattern of authentic flying saucer reports. 1. Worldwide sightings at long intervals up to the middle of the 19th century. 2. Concentration on Europe as the most advanced section of the globe until late in the 19th century. 3. Frequent surveys of America in the latter part of the 19th century, as we began to develop industrially, with cities springing up across the land. 4. Periodic surveys of both America and Europe during the gradual development of aircraft, from the early 1900s up to World War II. 5. An increase of observation during World War II, after German V-2s were launched up into the stratosphere. 6. A steadily increasing survey after our atomic bomb explosions in New Mexico, Japan, Bikini, and Inuitok. 7. A second spurt of observations following atom bomb explosions in Soviet Russia. 8. Continuing observations of the Earth at regular intervals, with most attention concentrated on the United States, the present leader in atomic weapons. Saucers have been reported seen over the Soviet Union, but the number is unknown. There is some evidence that Russia has an investigative unit similar to Project Saucer. There are other points of similarity to the program of American space exploration that I have outlined. Most of the extremely large saucers have been at high altitudes, some of them many miles above the Earth. At that height, a spaceship would be in no danger from our planes and anti-aircraft guns and rockets. The smaller disks and the mystery lights have been seen at low altitudes. Occasionally a larger saucer has been seen to approach the Earth briefly, as at Lockbourne Air Force Base, at Bethel, Alabama, at Macon and Montgomery, and other places. It has been suggested that this was for the purpose of securing atmospheric samples. It could also be to afford personal observation by the crews. The numerous small disks seen in the first part of the scare, in 1947, fit the pattern for preliminary and close observation by remote-controlled observer units. As the scare increased, the daytime sightings decreased for a while, and mystery lights began to be seen more often. This apparent desire to avoid unfavorable attention could have been caused by our pilots' repeated attempts to chase the strange flying objects. Authentic reports have described sightings over the following Air Force bases: Chanute, Newark, Andrews, Hickam, Robbins, Godman, Clark, Fairfield Susan, Davis Monthan, Harmon, Wright-Patterson, Holloman, Clinton County Air Force Base, and air bases in Alaska, Germany, and the Azores. Saucers have also been sighted over naval air stations at Dallas, Alameda, and Key West, and from the station at Seattle. They have been reported maneuvering over the White Sands Proving Ground, over areas containing atomic developments, above the Muroc Air Base testing area, and over the super-secret research base near Albuquerque. Several times saucers have paced both military and civil aircraft. Their actions strongly indicate deliberate encounters to learn our plane's speed and performance. It seems obvious that both the planes and the bases were being observed, and in some cases photographed by remote control units or manned spaceships. Although I thought it improbable that the location of our uranium deposits would be of interest to spacemen, a Washington official told me it would be relatively simple to detect the ore areas with airborne instruments. The Geological Survey has already developed special G-ger counters for planes, he told me. They had a little trouble from cosmic ray noise. They finally had to cover the G-gers with lead shields. Whenever an important amount of radiation is present in the ground, the plane crew gets a signal, and they spot the place on their map. It's a quick way of locating valuable deposits. When I told him what I had in mind, he suggested an angle I had not considered. Mind you, he said, I'm not completely sold on the interplanetary answer. But assuming it's correct, that we're being observed, I can think of a stronger reason, page 133, than fear of some distant attack. Some atomic scientists say that a superatomic bomb, or several set off at once, could knock the Earth out of its orbit. It sounds fantastic, but so is the A-bomb. It's just possible that some solar planet race discovered the dangers long ago. They would have good reason to worry if they found we were on that same track. There may be some other atomic weapon we don't suspect, even worse than the A-bomb, one that could destroy the Earth and seriously affect other planets. At the time, I thought this was just idle speculation. But since then, several atomic scientists have confirmed this official suggestion. One of these was Dr. Paul Elliott, a nuclear physicist who worked on the A-bomb during the war. According to Dr. Elliott, if several hydrogen bombs were exploded simultaneously at a high altitude, it could speed up the Earth's rotation or change its orbit. He based his statement on the rate of energy the Earth receives from the Sun, a rate equal to some 4 pounds of hydrogen exploded every second. Still other atomic scientists have said that H-bomb explosions might even knock a large chunk out of the Earth, with unpredictable results. A dramatic picture of what might happen if the Earth were forced far out of its orbit is indicated in the much-discussed book Worlds in Collision, by Dr. Emanuel Velikovsky, recently published by Macmillan. After many years of research, Dr. Velikovsky presents strong evidence that the planet Venus, when still a comet resulting from eruption from a larger planet, moved erratically about the sky and violently disturbed both the Earth and Mars. When the comet approached the Earth, our planet was forced out of its orbit, according to Worlds in Collision. For a time, the world was on the brink of destruction. Quoting many authentic ancient records, including the Quiche manuscript of the Mayas, the Ipower papyrus of the Egyptians, and the Vasiddhi Magga of the Buddhists, Dr. Velikovsky describes the cataclysm that took place. The face of the Earth changed, he writes in his book. The details, reinforced by the Zend Avesta of the Persians, tell of tremendous hurricanes, of a major upheaval in the Earth's surface, of oceans rushing over many parts of the land, while rivers were driven from their beds. Some of the events in this period are mentioned in the Bible. Professor Horace M. Collin, former dean of the New School of Social Research, strongly endorses Dr. Velikovsky's statements. It is my belief that Velikovsky has supported his thesis with substantial evidence, and made an effective and persuasive argument. Many other authorities endorse this work, which is documented with impressive references. But even if this particular account is not accepted, all astronomers agree that the effect of a comet passing near the Earth would be appalling. Worlds in Collision states that Mars, like the Earth, was pulled out of its orbit by the comet's erratic passage. It may be that this near disaster to the Earth and Mars is known on other solar planets, or remembered on Mars itself, if the planet is inhabited. The possibility of super bomb explosions on the Earth understandably disturb any dwellers on other solar system planets. This may be what was back of the Project Saucer statement on the probable motives of any visitors from space. I mentioned this Air Force statement in an earlier chapter, but it may be of interest to repeat it at this time. The comment appeared in a confidential analysis of intelligence reports, in the formerly secret Project Saucer document, Report on Unidentified Aerial and Celestial Objects. It reads as follows. Such a civilization might observe that on Earth we now have atomic bombs, and are fast developing rockets. In view of the past history of mankind, they should be alarmed. We should therefore expect at this time above all to behold such visitations. Since the acts of mankind most easily observed from a distance are A-bomb explosions, we should expect some relation to obtain between the time of the A-bomb explosions, the time at which the spaceships are seen, and the time required for such ships to arrive from and return to home base. Chapter 15. It was early in October 1949 when I finished the reversal of our space exploration plans. I spent the next 2 days running down a sighting report from a town in Pennsylvania. Like three or four other tips that had seemed important at first, it turned out to be a dud. When I got back home, I found Ken Purdy had been trying to reach me. I phoned him at Drew, and he asked me to fly up to New York the next day. "I've just heard there's another magazine working on the saucer story," he told me. "Who is it?" I said. "I don't know yet. It may be just a rumor, but we can't take a chance. We've got to get this in the January book." That night I gathered up all the material. It looked hopeless to condense it into one article, and I knew that Purdy had even more investigators' reports waiting for me in New York. Flying up the next morning, I suddenly thought of a talk I'd had with an air transport official. It was in Washington. I had just told him about the investigation. "If they are spacemen," he said, "they'd probably have a hard time figuring out this country by listening to our broadcasts. Imagine tuning in soap operas, The Lone Ranger, and a couple of crime yarns, along with newscasts about strikes and murders and the Cold War. They might pick up some of those kid programs about rocket ships. A few days of listening to that stuff, well, it would give them one hell of a picture." Except for some hoax reports, this was the first funny suggestion I'd had about the spaceman. But now, thinking seriously about it, I realized he had an important point. It was possible that men from another planet might have to reorient even their way of thinking to understand the Earth's ways. It would not be automatic, despite their superior technical progress. Evolution might have produced basic differences in their understanding of life. Humor, for instance, might be totally lacking in their makeup. What would they be like? I tried to imagine how they might look, without getting anywhere. Dr. H. Spencer Jones hadn't helped much with his life on other worlds. I couldn't begin to visualize beings with totally different cells, perhaps able to take terrific heat or bitter cold as merely normal weather. There were all kinds of possibilities. If they lived on Mars, for instance, perhaps they couldn't take the heavier gravity of the Earth. They might be easily subject to our diseases, especially if they had destroyed disease germs on their planet, a natural step for an advanced race. It was possible, I knew, that the spacemen might look grotesque to us. But I clung to a stubborn feeling that they would resemble man. That came, of course, from an inborn feeling of man's superiority over all living things. It carried over into a feeling that any thinking, intelligent being, whether on Mars or Wolf 359's planets, should have evolved in the same form. I gave up trying to imagine how the spaceman might look. There was simply nothing to go on. But there were strong indications of how they thought and reacted. Certain qualities were plainly evident. Intelligence. No one could dispute that. It took a high order of mentality to construct and operate a spaceship. Courage. It would take brave men to face the hazards of space. Curiosity. Without this quality, they would never have thought to explore far distant planets. There were other qualities that seemed almost equally certain. These spacemen apparently lacked belligerence. There had been no sign of hostility through all the years. They were seemingly painstaking and extremely methodical. It was still not much of a picture. But somehow, it was encouraging. Glancing down from the plane's window, I thought, how does this look to them? Our farms, our cities, the railroads there below, the highways, with the speeding cars and trucks, the winding river, and far off to the right, the broad stretch of the Atlantic. What would they think of America? Manhattan came into sight, as the pilot let down for the landing. An odd thought popped into my mind. How would a spaceman react, if he saw a Broadway show? Not long before, I had seen South Pacific. I could still hear Ezio Pinza's magnificent voice as he sang some enchanted evening. Was music a part of spacemen's lives, or would it be something new and strange, perhaps completely distasteful? They might live and think on a coldly intelligent level, without a touch of what we know as emotion. To them, our lives might seem meaningless and dull. We ourselves might appear grotesque in form. But in their progress, there must have been struggle, trial and error, some feeling of triumph at success. Surely these would be emotional forces, bound to reflect in the planet races. Perhaps, in spite of some differences, we would find a common bond, the bond of thinking, intelligent creatures trying to better themselves. The airliner landed and taxied in to unload. As I went down the gangway, I suddenly realized something. My last vague fear was gone. It had not been a personal fear of the visitors from space. It had been a selfish fear of the impact on my life. I realized that now. It might be a long time before they would try to make contact. But I had a conviction that when it came, it would be a peaceful mission, not an ultimatum. It could even be the means of ending wars on Earth. But I had been conditioned to this thing. I had had 6 months of preparation, 6 months to go from complete skepticism to slow, final acceptance. What if it had been thrown at me in black headlines? Even a peaceful contact by beings from another planet would profoundly affect the world. The story in true might play an important part in that final effect. Carefully done, it could help prepare Americans for the official disclosure. But if it weren't done right, we might be opening a Pandora's box. Chapter 16. That morning, at True, we made the final decisions on how to handle the story. Using the evidence of the Mantell case, the Chili's Witted report, Gorman's mystery light encounter, and other authentic cases, along with the records of early sightings, we would state our main conclusion. That the flying saucers were interplanetary. In going over the mass of reports, Purdy and I both realized that a few sightings did not fit the space observer pattern. Most of these reports came from the southwest states, where guided missile experiments were going on. Purdy agreed with Paul Riedel that any long-range tests would be made over the sea or unpopulated areas, with every attempt at secrecy. They might make short-range tests down there in New Mexico and Arizona, maybe over Texas, he said. But they'd never risk killing people by shooting the things all over the country. They've already set up a 3,000-mile range for the longer runs, I added. It runs from Florida into the South Atlantic. And the Navy missiles at Point Mugu are launched out over the Pacific. Any guided missiles coming down over settled areas would certainly be an accident. Besides all that, no missile on Earth can explain these major cases. Purdy was emphatic about speculating on our guided missile research. Suppose you analyzed these minor cases that look like missile tests. You might accidentally give away something important, like their range and speeds. Look what the Russians did with the A-bomb hints Washington let out. It was finally decided that we would briefly mention the guided missiles, along with the fact that the armed services had flatly denied any link with the saucers. After all, interplanetary travel is the main story, said Purdy. And the Mantell case alone proves we've page 139. Been observed from spaceships, even without the old records. The question of the story's impact worried both of us. Public acceptance of intelligent life on other planets would affect almost every phase of our existence business, defense planning, philosophy, even religion. Of course, the immediate effect was more important. Personally, I thought that most Americans could take even an official announcement without too much trouble. But I could be wrong. The only yardstick, and that's not much good, is that little man story, said Purdy. A lot of people have got excited about it, but they seem more interested than scared. The story of the little man from Venus had been circulating for some time. In the usual version, two flying saucers had come down near our southwest border. In the spacecraft were several oddly dressed men, 3 feet high. All of them were dead. The cause was usually given as inability to stand our atmosphere. The Air Force was said to have hushed up the story so that the public could be educated gradually to the truth. Though it had all the earmarks of a well-thought-out hoax, many newspapers had repeated the story. It had even been broadcast as fact on several radio newscasts. But there had been no signs of public alarm. It looks as if people have come a long way since that Orson Welles scare, I said to Purdy. But there isn't any menace in this story, he objected. The crews were reported dead, so everybody got the idea that spacemen couldn't live if they landed. What if a spaceship should suddenly come down over a big city, say New York, low enough for millions of people to see it? It might cause a stampede, I said. Purdy snorted. It would be a miracle if it didn't, unless people had been fully prepared. If we do a straight fact piece, just giving the evidence, it will start the ball rolling. People at least will be thinking about it. Before I left for Washington, I told Purdy of my last visit to the Pentagon. I had informed Air Force press relations officials of True's intention to publish the space travel answer. There had been no attempt to dissuade me, and I had been told once again that there was no security involved, that Project Saucer had found nothing threatening the safety of America. At this time I had also asked if Project Saucer files were now available. The Wright Field Unit, I was told, still was a classified project, both its files and its photographs secret. This had been the first week in October. When I asked if there was any other information on published cases, the answer again was negative. The April 27th report, according to press branch officials, was still an accurate statement of Air Force opinions and policies. So far as they knew, no other explanations had been found for the unidentified saucers. I am absolutely convinced now, I told Purdy, that here's an official policy to let the thing leak out. It explains why Forrestal announced our Earth Satellite Vehicle program years before we could even start to build it. It also would explain those Project Saucer hints in the April report. I think we're being used as a trial balloon, Purdy said thoughtfully. We've let them know what we're doing. If they'd wanted to stop us, the Air Force could easily have done it. All they'd have to do would be call us in, give us the dope off the record, and tell us it was a patriotic duty to keep still. Just the way they did about the uranium and atomic experiments during the war. He still did not have the name of the other magazine supposed to be working on the saucers. But it seemed a reliable tip. It later proved to be true, and from then on we worked under high pressure. In writing the article, I used only the most authentic recent sightings. All of the cases were in the Air Force reports. When it came to the Mantell case, I stuck to published estimates of the strange object's size. A mysterious ship 250 to 300 feet in diameter was startling enough. At first, I chose Mars to illustrate our space explorations. But Mars had been associated with the Orson Welles stampede. Most discussions of the planet had a menacing note, perhaps because of its warlike name. In the end, I switched to a planet of Wolf 359. The thought of those 8 light years would have a comforting effect on any nervous readers. The chance of any mass visitation would seem remote, if not impossible. But it would still put across the space travel story. As finally revised, the article, written under my byline, stated the following points as the conclusions reached by True. 1. For the past 175 years, the Earth has been under systematic close-range examination by living, intelligent observers from another planet. 2. The intensity of this observation, and the frequency of the visits to the Earth's atmosphere, have increased markedly during the past 2 years. 3. The vehicles used for this observation, and for interplanetary transport by the explorers, have been classed as follows. Type I, a small, non-pilot carrying disc-shaped craft equipped with some form of television or impulse transmitter. Type 2, a very large, metallic, disc-shaped aircraft operating on the helicopter principle. Type 3, a dirigible-shaped wingless aircraft that, in the Earth's atmosphere, operates in conformance with the Prandtl theory of lift. 4. The discernible patterns of observation and exploration shown by the so-called flying discs varies in no important particular from well-developed American plans for the exploration of space, expected to come to fruition within the next 50 years. There is reason to believe, however, that some other race of thinking beings is a matter of 2.25 centuries ahead of us. Following these points, I added a brief comment on the possibility of guided missiles, adding that the Air Force had convincingly denied this as an explanation of any sightings. As Purdy had suggested, I carefully omitted 10 minor cases that I thought might be linked with guided missile research. If disclosing the facts about space travel helped to divert attention from any secret tests, so much the better. True accepts the official denial of any secret device, I stated, because the weight of the evidence, especially the worldwide sightings, does not support such a belief. Most readers, of course, would know that some guided missile experiments were going on, and that True was fully aware of it. But our main purpose would be achieved. The fact that the Earth had been observed by beings from another planet would be fully presented. Some readers, of course, would reject even the fact that the saucers existed. Others would cling to the idea that they were of earthly origin. But the mass of evidence would make most readers think. At the very least, it would plant one strong suggestion that we, men and women of the Earth, are not the only intelligent species in the universe. When the article was finished, it was tried out on True's staff, then on a picked group that had not known about the investigation. One editor summed up the average opinion. It will cause a lot of discussion, but the way it's written, it shouldn't start any panic. The January issue, in which the story ran, was due on the stands shortly after Christmas. With my family, I had gone to Ottumwa, Iowa, to spend the holidays with my mother and sister. While I was there, the story broke unexpectedly on radio networks. Frank Edwards, Mutual Network newscaster, led off the radio comment. He was followed by Walter Winchell, Lowell Thomas, Morgan Beatty, and most of the other radio commentators. The wire services quickly picked it up. Some papers ran front-page stories. The publicity was far more than I had expected. I phoned a reporter in Washington whose beat includes the Pentagon. The Air Force is running around in circles, he told me. They knew your story was due, but nobody thought it would raise such a fuss. I think they're scared of hysteria. They're getting a barrage of wires and telephone calls. That night, as I was packing to rush back east, he called with the latest news. They're going to deny the whole thing, he said. But I heard one press branch guy say it might not be enough, they're trying to figure some way to knock it down fast. Next day, while changing trains at Chicago, I saw the Air Force statement. The press release was dated December 27, 1949. Without mentioning True, the Air Force flatly denied having any evidence that flying saucers exist. After examining 375 reports, the release said, Project Saucer had found that they were caused by 1. Misinterpretation of various conventional objects. 2. A mild form of mass hysteria or war nerves. 3. individuals who fabricate such reports to perpetrate a hoax or to seek publicity. Evaluation of the reports of unidentified flying objects, said the Air Force, demonstrates that they constitute no direct threat to the national security of the United States. Then came the clincher. Project Saucer, said the Air Force, had been discontinued, now that all the reports had been explained. It was plain that the release had been hastily prepared. It completely contradicted the detailed Project Saucer report, issued 8 months before, that had called for constant vigilance, after admitting that most important cases were unsolved. Anyone familiar with the situation would see the discrepancy at once. From Washington I flew to New York, where I found True in a turmoil. Long-distance calls were pouring in. Letters on flying saucers had swamped the mailroom. Reporters were hounding Purdy for more information. A hurried analysis of the first 100 letters showed a trend that later mail confirmed. Less than 5% of the readers ridiculed the article. Between 15 and 20% said they were not convinced. A few of these admitted they could not refute the evidence. About half the readers accepted the possibility. Most of these said they saw no reason why other planets should not be inhabited. The remainder, between 25 and 30%, said they were completely convinced. Even the disbelievers asked for more information. The intelligence level of the average letter was gratifyingly high. Comments came from scientists, engineers, airline and private pilots, college professors, officers of the armed services, and a wide variety of others, including far more women than True's readership usually includes. Several confidential tips had come in when I arrived. Most of them were from usually reputable sources. We were given evidence that Project Saucer was still in operation. Since its True code name was not Saucer, it could be continued without violating the Air Force press release. The same information was received from a dozen sources within the next 2 weeks. We were also told that there had been 722 cases, instead of 375. Meantime, a number of astronomers had come out with statements, pro and con. One of these was Dr. Dean B. McLaughlin, of the University of Michigan. "No one knows what the saucers are as yet," Dr. McLaughlin said. "They could be anything, and I'm willing to be convinced once the evidence is presented." Dr. Bart J. Bach of Harvard was on the fence. "After all," he said, "all sort of things float around in space. But I'm not convinced the saucers are anything."